Everybody. All right. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. The Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners will now come to order on May 9th, 2025, at 9 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C. Could I please have a roll call?
Robert Charles.
Here.
Brenda Dennis.
Here.
Christina Groves,
Here.
Lynette Hennigan,
Here.
Crystal Krueger, Jose Luis Madera,
Here.
Adelisa Meek,
Here.
Dominic Miller,
Present.
Diane Palacios,
Hello, good morning.
Teresa Pena,
Here.
Mark Shen.
Here.
All right, my name is Adelisa Meek. I'm a licensed professional counselor, a licensed independent addiction counselor, and I'm the board's chairperson. Can people hear me okay? Okay. At this time, I would like to remind everyone to please make sure that your phone is on silent or turned off. For your convenience, throughout the meeting, vending machines are right outside this room and the restrooms are across from the elevators. A couple of reminders: this is an open meeting and it is being recorded. The audio from the meeting will be posted on the board's website. Please be sure if you're speaking on the record that you speak clearly and into the microphone. In order to protect privacy, please keep in mind if it is necessary to refer to a client or former client, even if they are the complainant, to use initials only. At this time, I would ask my fellow board members and board staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Charles.
Bob Charles, public member.
Crystal Krieger, LMFT, professional member.
Morning, Mark Shen, professional member.
Brenda Dennis, public member, good morning.
Christina Groves, professional member, LMFT.
Dominic Miller, professional member, LCSW.
Diane Palacios, LPC, LIAC, professional member.
Lynette Hennigan, professional member, LCSW and LIAC.
Jose Luis Madera, whatever that was, professional member and LPC. It's Friday.
Good morning, everybody. Teresa Pena, public member.
Courtney Bennett, deputy director.
Hello, Fergala, Investigations Manager.
Jarrett Carver, Enforcement Manager.
Toby Zavala, Executive Director.
Scott Donald, Assistant Attorney General, acting as Board Counsel.
Thank you. Now we'll move to item number three, minutes. We have March 7, 2025, general meeting minutes. We have Ms. Dennis, Mr. Shen, and Ms. Dr. Hennigan abstain. So I have a motion to. That's also for B, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so we're doing both. Do I have a motion to approve minutes for March 7, 2025, general meeting minutes, and March 7, 2025, executive session minutes with Ms. Dennis, Mr. Shane, and Dr. Hennigan abstaining?
Palacios moves.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Now, April 11, 2025, general meeting minutes. Do I have a motion to approve with Ms. Gross abstaining?
So move Miller.
Palacios second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next is minutes for April 11, 2025, executive session minutes, and April 11, 2025, executive session minutes for 7B and 7P. Do I have a motion to approve with Ms. Gross and Mr. Charles abstaining?
Palacios moves.
Dennis seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Next on our agenda is item number four, our consent agenda. Items on the consent agenda appear with a recommendation from board staff. Board members have reviewed all of the material and the recommendations. We are prepared to vote on each matter as it appears on the agenda. Before doing so, I will call each matter to see if anyone here wishes to pull the matter. Pulling the matter means that you are a party to the matter, you do not agree with the recommendations, and you would like up to 5 minutes to address the board. If you wish to pull the matter, please raise your hand when it is called so I can take note that you are here. Items 4A, cases recommended for dismissal. I have Lauren Dodd, Brenda Fox, Lindsay Fry, Cynthia Garcia, Nicole Heim, Jody Livermon, Michaela Reddington, Jamie Richardson, and Jitel Rubin.
Madam Chair, Rubin was pulled.
Okay. So, all right. So hold on for Rubin. Do I have a motion to recommend dismissals, cases 4A, 1 through 8?
Blasius moves.
Hennigan second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And now do I have the... Okay, so the complainant for Rubin is on the phone. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, give me 1 second. So do we have Chanel Walker on the phone?
Madam Chair, it does not appear that the complainant is on the phone, but just as a note, she did state that they wanted it pulled, but we gave them instructions on how to join the Zoom and to be on promptly at 9 a.m. Being that they're not there, I would ask the members to consider moving forward with board staff's recommended dismissal.
Do I have a motion to dismiss case 4A9?
So move Miller.
Palacios second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next is item 4B, cases recommended for dismissal with a letter of concern. Rochelle Johnson, Bradley Newman. Did you raise your hand? Okay. Angela Wilson. All right, do I have a motion to dismiss with letter of concerns, item 4B, 1 through 3?
Palacios moves.
Miller second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next one is 4C, cases recommended for opening a complaint and dismissing with a letter of concern. Jacqueline Lafon. Do I have a motion for opening a complaint and dismissing with a letter of concern for 4C1?
Dennis moves.
One second. Oh, go ahead. Take it, Dennis.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next one, cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. I have Ms. Palacios, recruits from Terrence Banner. Terrence Banner, do I have a motion for accepting a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement for D1?
Trigger motions.
All in favor? Second?
In second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Ms. Palacios comes back for items D2. Jessica Dorrance. Molly Rich, sorry if I'm butchering the last name. All right, do I have a motion for acceptance of proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement for D1 and 3? I mean, 2 and 3?
Palacios moves. Krieger second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Next one is 4E. Cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement. Diana Whitney. Do I have a motion for opening a complaint and acceptance of proposed signed non-disciplinary consent agreement? Case 4E1.
Dennis moves.
Last second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. For F, cases recommended for acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement, Marie Tuller. Do I have a motion for accepting the proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement?
Hennigan moves.
Palacios second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
Aye.
Thank you. Next one is 4G, cases recommended for opening a complaint and acceptance of a proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement. Adriana Verdin. Cija Wilson. Do I have a motion for opening a complaint and acceptance of the proposed signed disciplinary consent agreement?
For your motions.
Do I have a second?
Palacio, second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
Aye.
Thank you. Next one, item 4I, cases recommended for opening a complaint for further investigation. Anthony Bratko and Yolanda Esugwu. All right, do I have a motion for opening a complaint for further investigation?
So move Miller.
Dennis seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item 4J, cases recommended for release from consent agreement. This is awesome. We have 14 cases. Do I have a motion for releasing from consent agreement items 4J 1 through 14?
Palacios moves. Krieger second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. All right. Next is item number 7. This is the time and place scheduled for board review of disciplinary matters. They will be heard by us pursuant to the authority given by ARS 323281. Those licensees or applicants on today's agenda received by mail a board meeting notice, which included a list of potential actions the board could take once we reach deliberation. This list is not exclusive, and there may be other options that the board considers. Board members have reviewed all of the materials submitted for each case. The board will first hear a summary of the case from board staff. Once staff is done, other interested parties, including the complainant, if applicable, and the professional, will be given the opportunity to address the board. In order to give everyone the same opportunity to address the board, we ask that those speaking do not take time repeating information that the board has already received. You and your legal counsel, if applicable, will collectively be given the same amount of time that board took to present the case, or 5 minutes, whichever is greater. Once the board has heard from the parties, we will move into deliberation. We ask during this time that you do not interrupt, as it is our time to talk amongst ourselves. If it is necessary at any time to refer to a client or former client, even if they are the complainant, to please use initials only. Please keep in mind that the board has a civility policy that prohibits disorderly conduct, and those in violation will be removed from the meeting. Before we begin, I want to advise you that this proceeding is being recorded. Accordingly, it is important that everyone speaks loudly and clearly, and that only one person speaks at a time. All right, so now we move to item 7E, Billy Jetland. And first, we're going to listen to a summary from board staff.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. Mr. Jetland and Mr. Barber, during the course of the interview, after the interview was conducted, it was discussed with board staff that Mr. Barber had recommended that he voluntarily have his client do a psychological evaluation. I will tell you that they have submitted to board staff an approval for that psychologist, which was approved. So he is doing it on a voluntary basis. But as our ordinary steps, I'm bringing it to the board for us to issue that order as well, just to ensure that it gets completed. Not sure that it's at this point, it's not necessarily to fine for the violation or even consider it based on what's in the analysis, as well as I believe what the attorney is going to be representing today.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for board staff? No? Okay, so you want to introduce yourself for the record, please?
And Madam Chair, if I could just share too, we need to see if the complainant is here.
Yes, is the complainant here? Okay, there's no complainant.
So again, Madam Chair, what you've heard today, I think that I would just ask the board members to consider issuing the order for the psychological evaluation. Clearly, he's in the presence of doing it voluntarily, but just to ensure that it gets completed. Once we receive the results of that evaluation, those results will come back to the following board meeting to be shared with you to consider not only the complaint, but the results of that evaluation.
Thank you, Ms. Arala. Dr. Krieger, so now we're just going to have a little discussion. Is this time for us to talk? And we ask that you not interrupt.
Okay. I did have a question. So we can issue that order without finding for violation.
Correct. That's our standard. Because at this point, even at this point, there's really not clear and convincing evidence that the violation is there. But what we use the evaluation as a tool to determine, where we want to go from here.
Right.
Okay. So unless my colleagues have anything to discuss, I think I'm good with issuing the order for the second evaluation, reviewing it at the next board meeting.
Is that your motion? Do I have a second?
Miller, second.
Do I need roll call?
Yes.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
Aye.
All right. Thank you. So that concludes this case for now, and you're free to go. Thank you. Next one, we have item 7B, Guillermo Galindo. It's an applicant. Mr. Galindo here. You can come to the front. And first, we're going to listen to a summary from board staff.
Madam Chair, members of the board, an applicant for licensure must meet requirements of ARS 32-3275, which includes the following. Section A5, not have committed any act or engaged in any conduct that would constitute grounds for disciplinary action against a licensee pursuant to this chapter. Following review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following. ARS 32-3251-16K, engaging in any conduct or practice that is contrary to recognized standards of ethics in the behavioral health profession, or that constitutes a danger to the health, welfare, or safety of a client as it relates to the following sections of the ACA. A6B, extending counseling boundaries. A8, multiple clients. This recommendation is based on the following. From 1221 to 1022, applicant provided behavioral health services to client at agency. Nowhere within client's treatment plan does it indicate family therapy as a modality or that client will have collaterals as part of his treatment. Client's notes within his records included the following in part. A 7/15/22 note indicated applicant conducted couples therapy and girlfriend and client discussed boundaries. A 7/29/22 note indicated applicant engaged in family supportive counseling with girlfriend and they discussed client and girlfriend and client's relationship. An 8/11/22 note indicated applicant engaged in family therapy with girlfriend regarding relationship issues and discussed ways to improve communication and her relationship with client. An 8/17/22 note indicated applicant engaged in counseling with girlfriend regarding her relationship with client. A 10/17/22 communication record indicated applicant spoke with girlfriend who explained she no longer wants to be in a relationship with client and applicant provided support and empathy. A 10/28/22 note indicated the following. Applicant met with client and his son to provide support with issues he is encountering. Client discussed the restraining order girlfriend filed against him and they discussed the relationship. Client's son engaged in the discussion and the focus changed to him. Applicant asked supportive questions regarding goals towards client's son's future. Due to allegations that applicant extended counseling boundaries, board staff subpoenaed applicant's phone records for his personal phone and work phone. Applicant's personal phone record showed the following. A 6/6/22, applicant called client once and sent a text message to client once. There was no communication between applicant and girlfriend on his personal phone. Applicant's work phone record showed the following communications. From 1221 to 1122, applicant and client exchanged 682 text messages and 74 phone calls. From 622 to 822, applicant and girlfriend exchanged 2,472 text messages and 83 phone calls. There were several times applicant had more than one phone call in a single day with girlfriend. There were several phone calls with girlfriend that lasted over an hour and the few calls that lasted 2 hours. Board staff also subpoenaed applicant directly for screenshots of communications in his possession between him and client and him and girlfriend, and applicant represented he did not have any in his possession at this time. Screenshots of text messages between client and applicant included the following. Applicant tells client that girlfriend loves him. Applicant and client refer to each other as bro several times. Applicant is trying to help client with the breakup and is helping girlfriend too because applicant thinks it's best for client from what client told him. Applicant has been counseling girlfriend like client asked, but client is applicant's main priority. Applicant is meeting with HR and asks client if he'd be willing to back up applicant, and a signed letter telling client's story would really help. Client says he loves applicant. Client needed help. He does not understand why applicant was adamant about helping girlfriend, and client did not receive the care he deserved. Applicant is done providing any support to girlfriend, and he did not think she could stoop this low and feels girlfriend tried to use applicant to get client in trouble. Client states applicant should have referred girlfriend to a colleague as it was a conflict of interest. A number of texts are regarding issues client is having with girlfriend. Despite the extensive texting and phone calls, it appears applicant failed to document any of the text messages within the record and failed to document roughly 140 calls he had with client or girlfriend. It's highly concerning that applicant engaged in several hundred texts and over 70 phone calls with client, with the majority of these communications not documented anywhere in the clinical record. Even more concerning is that applicant engaged in over 2,000 text exchanges with girlfriend and over 80 phone calls, with the majority of the calls and all of the texts not documented in the clinical record. Furthermore, there are screenshots of Facebook posts from girlfriend where she posts about applicant, and one post she even thanks applicant, stating he was not going to give up on her until she was free. Despite applicant representing that he was providing family support or family therapy when girlfriend or client's son was involved in client's therapy, there are no goals for family therapy or any documents signed by client attesting to girlfriend or his son's involvement in the therapy. Applicant also represented that he was providing counseling to girlfriend, yet represented it was not therapeutic, showing applicant's lack of insight into the services he was actually providing girlfriend. Applicant inappropriately extended his counseling boundaries by involving girlfriend and client's son in client's therapy without any sort of signed documentation or consents or collateral forms. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following. ARS 32-3251, 16X, exploiting a client, former client, or supervisee, and ARS 32-3251, 16BB, harassing, exploiting, or retaliating against a client, former client, research, subject, supervisee, coworker, witness or complainant in a disciplinary investigation. This recommendation is based on the following. From 8:20 to 11:22, applicant was employed at agency providing behavioral health services. From approximately 12:21 to 10:22, applicant provided services to client. In 11:22, applicant was terminated due to difficulties in understanding boundaries. In 11:22 investigative summary findings document by agency, the following is noted. Client alleged applicant asked him to write a letter to human resources and sign it. Client alleged applicant continued to text him after he repeatedly asked him to stop. Applicant acknowledged he asked client to write a letter to human resources and did not understand why this was unprofessional. Applicant admitted he continued to text client despite being asked to stop and that he did not maintain professional boundaries. In a 9/21/22 text, applicant texted client the following. I'm going to meet with HR myself. If you're willing to back me up, a signed letter telling your story would really help. Licensee represented the following. Applicant did not ask client to write a letter to HR on his behalf. He asked client to write a letter on his own behalf. In regards to applicant's statements to board staff asking if he could reach out to client for a letter, it was in desperation to figure out what could help. His idea was to visit client's parents' house as he remembered the location. He was going to reach out in person, not through phone, and client is also on Facebook. It is highly concerning and inappropriate that applicant not only asked a current client to write a letter of support for applicant, but considered going to client's parents' home to request a letter in defense of his board investigation. It is also concerning that despite the interaction being documented in his personnel records and in his text messages with client, applicant denied asking client to write a letter for him in his investigative interview. Additionally, in undated texts, client texts applicant stop and please stop on approximately 6 occasions in response to applicant apologizing, trying to explain his conduct, and discussing their ongoing disagreement. Applicant failed to cease communication with client after being repeatedly asked to stop reaching out and requested client to talk to him. Applicant also appears to lack insight as he represented he did not stop texting because client did not explicitly state stop texting. Furthermore, in a 3/24/25 email to board staff, applicant indicated the following. He could also contact girlfriend and see if she's willing to speak on the fact that they never met in person, not even on video chat. Applicant was also thinking there might be a possibility he could get in contact with some clients he had seen in the past, so board staff could get feedback from them. Applicant believes the power differential could only work against him because of the implied need for power developed of his false accusation. Applicant not only asked client for a letter, but represented to have reached out to girlfriend, a third party in this matter, for possible support in his investigation. Applicant also provided the Office of Unemployment Insurance numerous screenshots of texts between him and client, where client's first name is used, which included conversations around issues client was dealing with. With his submission to the Office of Unemployment Insurance, applicant also provided a screenshot of an agency email that included a summary of a phone call with client that included client's full name and date of birth. It is highly concerning that applicant felt it was appropriate to furnish an entity with client's personal information for his own benefit and defense of his termination from agency. Additionally, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following. ARS 32-3251-16T, disclosing a professional confidence or privileged communication, except as may otherwise be required by law or permitted by a legally valid written release. This recommendation is based on the following. Throughout client's therapy, applicant communicated with several individuals where there were no signed releases of information by client, allowing applicant to speak to them. Specifically, applicant involved girlfriend and client's therapy and even held individual phone sessions with girlfriend to discuss client and issues girlfriend was having with client. Furthermore, according to the phone records, applicant exchanged over 2,400 text messages and 83 phone calls with girlfriend, with a large majority of the communications not being documented in the clinical record. Client also brought his adult son to a therapy session where applicant and client discussed issues with client's relationship with girlfriend. Applicant also reported going to client's parents' home to try and outreach client. Applicant informed his parents that he was a healthcare provider and was trying to contact client. Despite applicant representing he did not share client's specific PHI with his parents, he fails to understand the possible breach of confidentiality by disclosing he was a healthcare provider. Applicant, in fact, did not obtain any sort of signed release of information or written authorization to speak to girlfriend, client's son, or client's parents. By involving others in client's therapy without a valid written release to do so, applicant breached client's confidentiality numerous times during the course of treatment. Applicant also believes that a release of information is only needed when disclosing PHI and fails to realize that involving someone in client's therapy without written authorization is in fact a breach of confidentiality. Even more concerning, applicant filed a claim with the Office of Unemployment Insurance as a defense, and as a defense, he provided the screenshots of his texts with client as well as a screenshot of an email that included client's full name, date of birth, and a summary of a phone call with client. And that is all I have, unless you have any questions for us.
Thank you, Mr. Carver. Any questions for staff? I do have a question. On the application, there's a statement from the supervisor. So the supervisor had recommended the applicant for license? I suppose.
You call which, recall which employer?
I'm sorry?
Do you recall which employer? Is it in the report? I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
If it's not in the report, then no, we did not obtain it.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions for staff? No questions? Okay. And Mr. Galindo, you have up to 11 minutes to address the board. Just remember, everything you have submitted, we have already read. So if there's anything in addition, go ahead.
He needs to turn on his microphone.
Oh, turn on your mic, please. Just push the button until there. There you go.
Okay. Is it on?
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Guillermo Galindo. I'm here because I believe that it is my purpose to be a therapist. I graduated this January from GCU, and through their endorsement, I was able to pass the NCE on my first attempt. My path to becoming a therapist came through the process of correcting my own dysfunction through my life. I stand here in order to acknowledge the most significant dysfunction I have discovered to date, and it's a hierarchical error in my cognition. I have been on quite an existential journey in the last couple of months, searching for the cause of my own dysfunction. My journey towards resolving this has been a spiritual experience for me. After a lot of introspection, I arrived at the foundation of my morality, which derives from Christianity. My ethics, which have been developed since childhood, at a fundamental law, I place my ethics of Christianity before all others. I previously believed that faith took precedence over ethics and logic. But when ethical challenges arose, my ethics and logic were compared in accordance to my Christian beliefs. One of the reasons my faith took a very powerful precedence in my mind is due to a fundamental core belief, which is to live in a way that when I die, God tells me the world was better because I was here on earth than is if I was never born. This core idea interfered with my ability to identify that my faith was an issue and reinforced my faith in God's teaching as my moral authority. When I first discovered my flaw was during the interview with the board investigators. I realized I had placed religion over ethics, but I did not yet believe it to be the cause of my dysfunction, so I continued to search. It was not until several other thoughts led me to the conflict between religiousness and ethics that I took the idea seriously. This is when I discovered that it was not just a little mistake, but a huge misconception that when adopted, can spread fiercely among believers and has caused thousands of wars and millions of deaths. When people place religion before ethics, it is very easy to lose sight of ethics that keep society whole. Also, the ethics that serve the goal we are aiming towards is fundamental and cannot derive from religion because religion's text is subject to interpretation. After this shift in perception, I was able to look at my violations objectively, and it was clear that I was in violation. I discovered multiple issues with my past perceptions. Some of the things I learned is logic is a tool for examining all perspectives and should not just be limited to comparing issues to my faith. Ethics is a higher priority over faith because horrible things have been done when faith controls logic and is above ethics. When believing religion is the foundation of morality and ethics, there is a shift of perception that happens that causes you to think you have the key, that your answer is the right one, creating some sort of moral authority, which in hindsight does seem delusional. I was stubborn. I always needed to know why in order to accept information. I attribute this cognitive distortion to be the issue of all the charges of my conduct. Knowing what I know now, I feel as if I have been childish and self-centered. My previous thought process was misguided. I was beginning with the outcome, something that was good, and then attempting to justify and rationalize the steps in between as part of the ethics that make it right. I believed that the ends justify the means. If it was for the greater good. In conclusion, my faith, my ethics, my logic have been challenged and adapted. I now understand and believe the ethics of the ACA and the board are guidelines developed to limit and guide conduct, communication, and relationships in a way that protect and secure the client, their families, and the therapist. Now that I think about the ACA code of ethics, it's similar to a modern religious text. The emotional turmoil I have experienced in this investigation process is the outcome of prioritizing my own morality over the ACA code of ethics. Throughout this process, my mantra to keep my sanity has been, I have faith in the path that God has in front of me. The challenges I face are lessons I need to learn. And when I feel suffering, it's because I have doubt in his path. Now I feel thankful that the ACA code of ethics, I feel thankful that the ACA code of ethics exists because the hard work is already done. I feel secure and have faith that his writing is not to be challenged. I continue to believe in God and have faith in his path for me, even more now that I have this perspective to give the ACA code of ethics proper respect it deserves. This adjustment process has also given birth to a new perspective. When I experience conflict and resistance, the issue is not external, but it is within me. I hope the board can consider my change of perspective, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before we continue, I want to make a parenthesis. I asked a question about supervisor recommendation and realized that the applicant is applying for an LAC, so that's not required. Any board members have questions for the applicant? Dr. Kruger, okay.
Yeah. And maybe this. So, were you receiving supervision?
I was.
Okay. At what point did you discuss treatment and working with multiple members of a family with your supervisor?
Before it happened.
Okay. What were the considerations that you and your supervisor considered in terms of risk to this client and the family members involved?
I don't remember much analysis. It was 2.5 years ago. I remember that it was me requesting permission and getting granted the permission. Okay. Okay.
And then just one more question. Looking back now, considering the time between when this happened, what harm do you think that this caused the client?
I mean, the boundary issues are pretty significant. It must have caused so much confusion. They might have lost trust in counseling. I've thought about the breach of confidentiality and how that might have affected their employment or future. Just people knowing things that they shouldn't have known or seeing things that they shouldn't have seen because they are in a position of power that could negatively affect decisions in their future or might create some sort of bias.
Thank you.
I have some questions.
Okay, Mr. Madera.
You want to go first?
No, go ahead.
Oh, thank you. What was your, because you're just applying right now for your LAC, so you just graduated from GCU recently, correct?
Right.
What was your role at that time? Because I looked at the things and people, I referred you as the CM. So were you the case manager? What was your role with this group of folks?
So it was a grant position. The grant they called Project Elevate. It was outreach, and it was different than case management because there was way less limitations. I was doing outreach to people at parks for opioid addiction.
Okay.
Parks, they were in alleys. I was asked to transport non-clients. I was given permission to transport non-clients to the hospital for detox in hopes that they would join our program following.
But can you just answer the question real quick? What was your role? Like, if I had to say, what was your title? Just real simple.
It was such a vague position. I can't really put a definition on it.
But what was your
title? Signed a job description. What did you
think? It was substance abuse specialist.
Right.
Okay. Got it. And then my next question is, with the treatment plan, can you explain to us like why it's important to have a treatment plan and what it needs to be and kind of some of the discussion that was in this about the treatment plan and what the services you provided?
Right. I mean, there's multiple reasons. There's autonomy that the client has and is involved in their own treatment, that we're focused on specific goals that are both agreed upon and can be a priority and guidance to treatment. I mean, of course, it helps with insurance and documentation, but it just gives an overall perspective to the purpose they're even involved in treatment, and it gives the client the basically authority over the treatment and the direction of the treatment.
That's all.
All right. Any other question? I have a question. At some point during the investigation, you said that you could probably contact some clients so that board staff could reach out to them. Do you still have, you know, those contacts for former clients in your possession?
No.
Okay.
And that perspective was wrong. That was.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. No other questions for the applicant? All right. So now it's going to be time for us to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And Mr. Miller, you're leading the discussion.
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know where I stand and kind of my thinking, but I do seek your feedback before I move to make a motion. Just initial thoughts on allowing the applicant to move forward or not.
I have a general statement, just because we've seen similar things come up where faith-based services or counseling or religion or however you would want to name it will also get mixed in with counseling and with therapy. And people sometimes can have a really hard time distinguishing what those boundaries are. And I think that's, you know, that's a big concern of coming from a different, you know, background, or coming from a ministry or a faith background where you're, you know, the rules are different, the boundaries are different. Just, it's so important for, you know, just to hear for anyone who's in school, or who, you know, anyone who's trying to get licensed, that to really understand the boundaries, really understand the ethics, because it's very different and it has to be very clean and very separated. So I just felt like I needed to say that.
I have concerns going many directions here.
Mm-hmm.
I know, Ms. Meek mentioned, you know, are you under clinical supervision? And I know he's not licensed, but he was getting clinical oversight from a BHP who is licensed. As I read these notes, I think they failed him. I think that I'm actually really concerned about the organization itself. You look at some of these notes and things don't add up. The notes don't make any sense. The duration of the service makes no sense. And what that tells me, that's a clear sign that somebody wasn't reviewing his work. Because just reading these notes, just reading a couple of these notes tells me they didn't read it. You know, there's a note here for 225 minutes of care. And you read the note, and that looks to me like a 5-minute conversation. So that in itself would be sent back saying, hold on a second. Like, tell me about your therapeutic interventions. Tell me about what's happening beyond the session. And I think that the individual who is hoping to be licensed could have been helped to grow and do things better, because this didn't help him at all.
Well, and I question his role. That's why I his title, because in 20, he wasn't in school probably at that point, right?
Yeah.
That's the rub.
Yeah.
That was my thought too, is was he practicing in a therapeutic role at that time?
Well, and I looked at title. I don't know if you guys saw kind of in the documentation, I'm trying to get back to it. But title is actually something having to do with coach, a recovery coach was title. Peer support. So a lot, I would say probably a lot differently than kind of even what he said to us, right? So coaching is a lot different than what was said. But I do share a lot of the same concerns, I think, with, you know, I think failure of like the supervisor, because I think that some of these things could have been caught, you know, and maybe worked out, right? But ultimately we're here and this is what happened and there was some harm done to a client.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about public members' perspective.
I have a lot of thoughts. I don't know where to go with them. There definitely was some failure from the role of the agency. With the proper supervisor relationship, would this be different? I hope so. I don't know that it would be. And so is this a case where someone got too close to the fire and now they've pulled away and they've learned and they can be readjusted, or the opposite? I don't know. I'm really looking towards you all.
Yeah.
On where you lean.
And a concern that kind of is brought up for me is there's several times where this client asked the professional to stop contact, and we didn't stop contact, and we just kept going forward. So part of me has a little bit of like, I just want to make sure we're okay to actually practice. Does that make sense? Because to me, and I think to most of us in the room, if someone asks you to stop, you're going to stop, right? You're not going to go to, you know, extensive measures to continue contact with that individual.
Yeah.
I kind of agree
with that. But if he was operating in the sense of peer support recovery coach, I don't know if the directive was to keep, and this, you're in a grant program for opioid, it's a little bit more aggressive. So was he also being giving directive? I don't know if you were given directive to keep outreaching, even though he said stop, but this is somebody we need to grasp a hold to. Because sometimes that can happen. So
yeah, but
I have an issue with that too, and the stopping.
Part of it to me is like, I mean, we took it steps further, right?
Yeah.
And showed up at someone's house. Right.
So I think that, I mean, we seem to share same concerns, right? We had to take into account that he was a peer support. He was not a professional, right, at that level. And I think that with a very nicely developed consent agreement, right, that he would have that opportunity to learn. And, you know, I think that he has learned from this experience. I think that the insight that he shared brings awareness to where he went in the different direction and what direction he needs to take now. And I think that with really good supervision.
If the board's comfortable with that, because I'm with, you know, Mr. Charles, really with a lot of thoughts, but still a lot of concerns. And I, you know, sit here and I'm not convinced in either direction that there would be safety to practice unless there was a very, very strict consent agreement.
Yeah,
I agree with that. I have a lot of concerns around insight. I appreciate that the applicant came and told us that he's thinking about things differently and he understands some conflicts between a Christian ethic and ACA ethics and things like that. But what I didn't actually hear were specifics that made me think, okay, I do see insight happening here. It felt like it was at a really high level, and I'm not 100% convinced that we still don't have an insight problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. At the same time, I think that maybe he hasn't been given the opportunity to have a good supervisor, right, and learn the things that he doesn't know or learn the things that, you know, he needs to learn. So
I just want to prevent him ever having to come back here again, ultimately, right, is what I would like us to develop, if that makes sense. Like, you know, let's.
Yes, Madam Chair, I agree with your comment because I also think that a well-structured program, peer services program, is going to be of great help because that's another thing that I don't sense that the program was well-structured, you know, and I'm not even sure what the metrics were, you know, to being tied to a grant, we can make sure or be sure that there is metrics and outcomes expected. So, I agree with you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I ask the applicant a question? Sure. So what is your, you know, if you were to be granted a license, what would your employment plan be? What do you see yourself wanting to do and what populations are you hoping to serve?
Focused on population. I enjoy working with adults because they possess more ability to receive information and adapt more insight to their own behaviors and just better communication skills overall. More of a equality level communication. I've had opportunity to work with children, and I just didn't find it as progressive. I did I want to work with the proper agency, with the proper supervisor, and want to adapt to have proper ethics and communication and boundaries. I don't want to make any mistakes. When I think about my old self, I was convincing myself that I was right. When I was younger, I grew up with a different culture, and lying was normal, and I don't want to live in a way where I have to lie. I want to be able to be myself.
Thank you.
And be honest.
Yeah, thank you. And so it sounds like an agent also working in an agency culture as well, correct? Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Ms. Vala, do I first find for, I'm sorry, do I first open the complaint and find for the violations?
That is correct.
Thank you. I make a motion to open a complaint and find for the violations of ARS 3232-5116K, extending counseling boundaries as it relates to the ACA Code of Ethics, A6B and A8, and 16X, exploitation and harassment, and 16BB, harassing, exploiting, or retaliating against a client, and 16T, breach of confidentiality.
Rov, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? All right, motion carries. And yeah.
So let's do this strict consent agreement together, because I have a couple things already written down, but please add into or change as we kind of go through it. But I was thinking 24 months, clinical supervision twice monthly. Obviously no supervised private practice, but I think that might be a given. And then I'm wondering about either a graduate course on ethics and other types of training, your thoughts on that. Because there is, evidence of Relias trainings with ethics and things like that. He has gone through and passed the exam, mm-hmm. But I still think a graduate course would be warranted in this case.
Mm-hmm. I think so
too. Okay.
I would say supervision once a week.
You want to do once a week?
Strict on that, mm-hmm. Because I think we're talking about having a very mm-hmm. comprehensive consent agreement.
Okay. So. Mm-hmm. Ms. Savala, changing the clinical supervision to once a week?
For 24 months.
Yep. Early release, any thoughts on that? I was saying no.
Yeah.
No early release.
Okay. What about, this might be not appropriate, whatever, but I'm going to say it. It's obvious that the licensee's faith is extremely important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And applicant's faith is important to him. And why not some training on best practices regarding integrating faith mm-hmm. into a counseling environment?
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he understands that there really aren't that many differences, that he could provide it in an ethical manner, which would give more meaning to what he's doing for his clients. He may even find a population that just fits better with. But I would love to see some training on just how to integrate faith and practice and best practices for
that. I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. He just graduated and he's at GCU.
And he's more.
There's the whole
needs
premise
more courses.
They talked about.
Can we include that maybe as a focus of supervision? Mm-hmm. Like maybe making that be like something that we would like the supervisor to kind of possess, like they're already doing that. Like,
first of all, can you...
So what I had put down for the focus, just based on the violations and the discussion I've heard today, was confidentiality, behavioral health, ethics, boundaries, integrating faith and practice into a counseling environment, as well as statutes and rules.
Does that help with what you were saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know if we necessarily maybe need to do like a
course
or CEUs on that, because I think that he's gotten a lot of that.
Sure.
So just putting it into practice.
We'll keep those focus.
Yeah.
Items, Ms. Avala. Anything else?
I think I kind of like that focus of an additional training, maybe not a graduate level course, but maybe some kind of CEs to kind of reinforce that after we've had this kind of a problem.
I agree with that.
So CEs pertaining to specifically?
Does anyone know of any specific ones?
I'm not aware of that.
Integrating
what Mr. Shin said, you know,
spirituality into
I'm sure that
Chair members, are you aware of
yeah, I think there's
there's a Counseling Association or something. Google.
There's a Christian Counseling Association. They are required to do that from there.
Yeah.
I'm also wondering too, is just because the applicant is on this journey, I don't know if we can issue this, but counseling to be able to just continue to process his own journey.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's the trauma that he alludes to.
Yes.
It may need to be is coming up.
Yeah, I've heard it several times. It seems a little deeper than supervision.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What frequency?
I think, you know, if we're doing weekly supervision, I think maybe twice a month for the first year, once a month for the second year, at the discretion of the therapist. And I don't know, you know, just to stay on record, I know we can't issue this, but maybe even a faith-based therapist could be helpful as, you know, he's working through some of, you know, faith and ethics.
So therapy twice a month for the first year, and then the second year once monthly?
At least, right?
At least. At the discretion of the therapist? Okay.
And we have restricted SPP, right?
Yes, restrict supervised private practice as well.
And no supervision?
Yes, supervision.
No, I mean, he cannot provide it.
Correct.
I'm sorry. Good, everybody.
Can I just clarify in regards to the therapy twice a month, monthly for the first year, after that, at the recommendation of the therapist one time, or could that be early release for the therapy?
I think therapy is individualized, so at the discretion of this therapist. Yeah.
All right, so we will be offering the applicant a consent agreement for 24 months. They will be required to get clinical supervision once a week. The focus will be on statutes and rules, confidentiality, behavioral health ethics, boundaries, integrating faith and practice into a counseling environment. Also be required to take a 3-credit graduate level course in behavioral health ethics. Also be required to complete 3 CEUs in integrating faith and practice into a counseling environment. There'll be a practice restriction, no supervised private practice. You will also be required to get therapy for the first year twice monthly, and after that, at the recommendation of the therapist. And that therapist will be specialized in faith-based. And if not signed, denied for unprofessional conduct. Would that be your motion?
So moved, Miller. Yes, that's my motion.
Palacio, second.
Can I make just a parenthesis here? I think it's very important for supervisors listening out there that when there's a consent agreement with specific recommendations for supervision, that those recommendations are reflected, that you're addressing those recommendations in your reports. Just to be clear that you are following our recommendations. All right. I had a motion and a second. Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
Aye.
All right, so that concludes this case. Mr. Galindo, you will be contacted by our board staff. And if you have any questions, you can call your investigator. All right.
Madam Chair, a quick comment?
Yes.
To the applicant. This could have gone a very different direction, I think. And I just want you to be aware that that could have been the case. So I hope you do the best with this opportunity we're giving you today. Thank you. That's it.
All right. Take care. Thanks. Thanks for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the board, if we could pause and go back to agenda item 4A9. It was notified to us that staff inadvertently provided the complainant the wrong information to sign into the Zoom. They contacted us. And so I believe that our licensee Ruben is here still and the complainant is now on the correct Zoom. So I would like to go back as to be fair to the complainant who did want this matter to be heard.
Madam Chair, can we take a quick break? I'm sorry.
All right. We're going to take a 10-minute break at 10 a.m. We'll be back at 10:10. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
All right, the board is back in session at 10:09, and I understand Chanel Walker is on the phone.
Yes, and Madam Chair, just for the record, as this was previously dismissed because the complaint wasn't on because we inadvertently gave him the wrong information, the licensee has left the building, and so we do think that we should go ahead and move forward with the case at this time. If the board members have a different decision based on the recommendation of board staff, we would then table the matter. But for right now, I think we should listen to the complainant and determine whether it's a dismissal.
Okay, thank you. So do we have Chanel Walker on the phone? Hello, Chanel Walker? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes, okay. Good to hear that you're there. My name is Adalessa Meek. I'm the board chairperson. And we're here getting ready to listen to the case for Hotel Robin. And so first, just to want to let you know that I'm sitting here with members of the board, members of the staff, and public members, and this meeting is being recorded. So first, we're going to listen to a summary of the case, and then I'll call you so you can address the board. All right, so staff can give us some the summary, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigated record, there does not appear to be clear and convincing evidence to support the complainant's allegation. Also would like to note that the complainant's job was a video editor and was not a behavioral health physician in any way. And that's all I have, unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions for Ms. Zavala? Being no questions, Ms. Walker, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board.
Okay, thank you.
And just, I'm sorry, I forget to mention this, but just know that we have read all the information that has been submitted already. So if you have anything in addition to report to the board, we appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Chanel, and I'm here today to speak in regards to agenda item A, case number 2025-0214 involving Ms. Skittle Rubin, LPC 22593, which is currently listed for dismissal under the consent agenda. I am speaking as a directly impacted party. In November 2024, I began working with Ms. Rubin through a college internship placement as a video editor. This was a professional creative role, not a clinical or peer support position. I was part of a small team of interns, including an illustrator and animator, assigned to develop educational content for Ms. Rubin's business relative to mental health. However, during the course of that internship, I experienced several incidents that I believe constituted serious boundary violations and misuse of positional authority, and emotionally inappropriate dynamics within a supervisory setting. These experiences had a significant impact on my emotional well-being and created a climate of confusion and distress, especially given the professional power dynamic between us. In response to my concerns, I formally withdrew from the internship and reported the matter to my educational institution. As a result, Ms. Rubin was removed from the university's internship portal called Handshake, and the matter remains under active institutional investigation. Dismissing this case while that investigation is still open sends a concerning message, one that may imply that student interns working in proximity to licensed professionals fall outside the board's ethical purview simply because their roles are non-clinical. I believe this is a dangerous precedent to set. Harm in professional relationships doesn't require a therapy room to be real. And students who are beginning their careers, even in creative or technical fields, deserve protection when supervised by licensed mental health professionals who hold power, influence, and ethical obligations. Today, I'm not asking for a specific sanction or outcome. What I'm asking is simple, that this matter not be dismissed today, that it be removed from the consent agenda for further individual review, and that the board consider whether Ms. Rubin's conduct, particularly within a power imbalance, emotionally vulnerable internship context, merits deeper ethical review in alignment with your mandate to protect the public. Thank you for your time and for your ongoing commitment to upholding professional integrity in all spaces where licensees hold influence.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the complainant from board members? Okay, there are no questions. So now we asked Ms. Walker, to put your phone on silent as the board will discuss. And we ask that you not interrupt. All right. So do we have any comments on this case? Any questions? Any different recommendations?
We only have jurisdiction over counseling profession or, you know,
behavioral health.
Thank you. Yes.
Right. So with no further discussion, do I have a motion to dismiss?
Dennis motions.
Last year, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So the case has been dismissed. And Ms. Walker, this completes this case and you're free to go. Thank you. All right. Next, we go to item 7C. Bethany Grismore, applicant. Is the applicant here? Okay. So first, we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff. And then I'll ask you to introduce yourself in just a minute.
Madam Chair, members of the board, an applicant for licensure must meet all requirements of ARS 323275, which includes the following, A5 and A6. Following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation, ARS 323251-16L. Engaging in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. This recommendation is based on the following. From 8/20 to 7/22, applicant was licensed as an LAC with the board. On 2/18/22, the board received two complaints against applicant alleging licensee reached out to a client from agency through social media requesting drugs. On 3/14/22, applicant submitted to a hair follicle drug test which showed positive results. Due to the positive results, board staff contacted applicant about the option of entering into an ICA, which was suspend her license while she tended to her substance use recovery efforts. On 7/31/22, while under the ICA, applicant's license expired and she failed to renew her license. On 4/29/24, applicant applied for an LAC license with the board and her application was forwarded to investigations for a full background investigation. Applicant had a relapse around 5/24 and board staff offered applicant the option to place her application and investigation on hold due to recent relapse, which applicant agreed to. Applicant provided numerous drug screens from 3/24 to 1/25, as well as 4/2/25, a 12-panel hair follicle test, which all yielded negative results for substances. A 2/13/25 letter writing by sponsor indicated applicant has shown positive growth and dedication. From 3/22 to 10/22, applicant was engaged in services, as well as 10/22 to 11/22, applicant was inpatient at Sabino Recovery. Discharge records indicate applicant was a full participant in the treatment program with a fair prognosis for continued sobriety while completing the requirements of the treatment program. From 2/24 to 8/24, applicant received behavioral health services from Southwest Network, where she attended services regularly. Despite applicant being involved in behavioral health services regularly for the past several years, there are concerns that applicant had gaps in services at times. Furthermore, it appears applicant had roughly 8 years of sobriety before her relapse in 2022 and then another brief relapse in 2024. And that's all I have unless you have any questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Any board members have questions for staff? Okay, having none. Ms. Grisman, you have the floor and you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. And if you can introduce yourself first.
My name is Breton Barber. I'm an attorney for Ms. Bethany is how I know her, this is Ms. Gisler. I'll just make a brief statement and then turn it over to my client. I represented Bethany back in 2022 when these issues first came into being and she signed the interim consent agreement. She's come a long way, I can just say as her attorney. I hope that's reflected in the investigative report. I think it is. Certainly we both recognize there are legitimate concerns that the board and the board staff has should you allow her to obtain a license. We certainly don't dispute that there are violations. She fully freely admits to those and has in interviews. I've been in recovery for over 16 years. I know that relapse is a part of recovery, unfortunately, for many people. I certainly hope that you can see the potential that she has and consider finding a violations, but also offering her a consent agreement so that we can hopefully see her succeed in this profession to help others, and also ensure that the people that she potentially treats are safe. With that, I'll have my client make a statement and allow her to answer any of your questions.
Yes, thank you.
Hi, I'm Bethany Grismore. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address you all this morning. I know that you've all read all the pieces. I'm really grateful for this opportunity that I've been given to look at places where I need to grow. I'm very committed to my recovery. I'm very committed to the clients that I hope to work with again someday. I feel very led in this profession to be doing great work. I have done some wonderful things for which I am very grateful, and I hope to get back to that. I feel very sad and sorry for the actions that I was participating in at that time. It's been a long time, and a lot of growth, a lot of looking into myself and finding places that I needed to address, both personally and professionally. And I'm really looking for the opportunity to continue down this career path. I very much appreciate the opportunity. I think that's all.
Thank you very much. Any board members have questions for the applicant?
I do. Ms. Gismore, what populations are you interested in serving?
For now, I'd like to focus mostly on family type services, probably stay out of substance use for a time while I address my own recovery efforts, just because it tends to be a little bit overwhelming at times, I've learned. I was running myself very thin at the time of the allegations. And so a big piece of what I'm looking to do is to really balance. I'm a law student currently in the legal paraprofessional program for family law at the U of A. And so what I'm hoping to do is to keep a workload that has to do with integrating counseling and law in some way. So that's kind of what I'm looking for.
Thank you.
Since what you just said, could you expand a little bit of how do you integrate counseling and law? What kind of like jobs do that?
It might look like, you know, if given the opportunity, doing counseling a few days a week with clients, and then pursuing, I'm still in school, but pursuing legal paraprofessional in a family law. That came about because I did have a court case after these allegations came for my children. And so I had a family lawyer who is also a counselor. And she recommended that I look into that program as a way of. So there's a lot more to investigate on what it might look like. Obviously, keeping the roles separate would be really important. So I'm not sure. It began as a backup plan to whatever happens here.
Okay.
So
we could use a lot of therapy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Okay, Dr. Hennigan.
I know that you're doing, it says in the report, you're doing some counseling and you exercise regularly. Going to law school is a heavy lift. What other self-care activities are you doing to help kind of maintain your stress level?
Yeah. I have a wonderful therapist who I see actually during my school week. She's in Tucson where I've been going to school, and I don't work right now, just going to school. Keeping everything balanced is the most important thing for me right now. And so I do love my therapist. I do attend meetings daily. I missed my meeting this morning. I don't always feel right when I don't attend my recovery meetings. I spend a lot of time working with others in that 12-step environment. And then regular exercise, diet, nutrition is really important to me. I need to eat, sleep, and all, you know, all the self-care is kind of the lesson that I've learned within all of this, paramount to everything.
Thank you.
So if your license is granted, would you be doing therapy soon?
I would
be providing therapy. Okay.
I would hope to be, as long as the work-life balance kind of worked.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry. Any other board members have any questions?
Yeah, in your mind as a therapist in the future, if we allow you to move forward and you do come across your triggers within that work, mm-hmm. how are you going to deal with them? I know that's general.
I know. It's a hard thing to answer. Which trigger, what type of trigger, things like that.
Well, yes, and kind of your thought process as of today, like how would you deal with yourself in the future if you had that moment of transference or countertransference occur in session?
I would really heavily rely on supervision, mm-hmm. especially for those situations. But I also, you know, I was able to share within the investigation and interview, you know, there was so much going on at the time that was triggering me in the environment that I was working. I was in the prison at the time. I was going through a divorce. And so I've had lots of time to reflect on what that looks like and the awareness. And so I think for me, being aware of what's happening can cause me to actually address it much sooner. Mm. So that's really been the key. In looking at professionally, you know, who am I reaching out to when I feel it and hitting, you know, catching it as soon as I possibly can.
Right.
And so depending on the type of trigger, like if it were a substance abuse trigger, I have lots of people to call, lots of resources to use. If it were more of a mental health thing, then supervision and my therapist. And I have a large support system at this time.
Thank you. I answered my question.
Any other questions? All right, so being none, this is going to be time for us to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And we have Ms. Palacios, you're leading the discussion.
Yeah, so I think it's clear that Ms. Grismore has taken her recovery efforts seriously and has done a lot of work. And so I would be comfortable finding for a violation and then crafting a consent agreement for her. Is everyone on board with that? All right. So
wrote down. Everybody in agreement.
All right. So I would propose that we find for violation behavioral health concerns, ARS 32.
Madam Chair, Ms. Palacios, can we open a complaint with that as well, please?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. That's what I was doing.
You were fighting for the violation.
Oh, so open a complaint and find for the violation. Yes. Okay. ARS behavioral health concerns, ARS 32-32-51-16L. Engaged in any conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of the licensee to safely and competently practice in the licensee's profession. So that's my motion.
Grove seconds.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, motion carries. And recommendations?
Yeah, so what I'm thinking for consent agreement is 12 months and continuing with counseling twice a month, continuing with psych services. I would put a stage suspension in case of relapse. And then every other quarter, do a 10 hair follicle test. And then also just hearing today, maybe a 3-hour CEU on self-care. Any other
Did
thoughts?
Did you say clinical supervision?
Counseling.
It wasn't like a supervision issue though. So it's more.
I get that. Yeah. My thought was that supervision might be helpful should she have to bring something to supervision that may have triggered like a counter transference moment.
Mm-hmm.
But comfortable with what you've said so far.
I think if she has a counselor.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that, let's see.
Does the paid suspension prevent supervised private practice?
Let's also add that on there okay. as well to restrict yep. supervised private practice. I did have that in my mind.
Okay.
And so LEC applicant, and so she'll be under supervision regardless,
yeah.
getting her hours. And so I'm hoping that would just be something that organically would come up and just hearing from the applicant today, it sounds like that she's pretty transparent in that it would.
Okay.
Well, I think that maybe we need to put it on the consent agreement, the supervision, because LACs could choose jobs and not pursue right? The independent license. And so they would not necessarily be under supervision. Is that right, Ms. Zavala?
I mean, that is correct. I think what you need to think about, though, is what would the focus of the clinical supervision be, being that it's not clinically related
to the,
it seems that if you've got the 10 hair follicle in place, mm-hmm. That's going to at least, provide information to the board that she's clean and sober. And then with the therapy, she's going to continue to be able to work on that treatment plan. Mm-hmm. So I think, it would definitely.
We'll address the.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I feel that too. And even just hearing her today, I do my meetings every day. And if I miss a meeting, it's just, so I think it's just, she's on the track where she needs to be.
Agreed.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. All right. So do you have a. Did we already put, yeah.
Can I clarify in regards to the PCP? You basically just stated to continue with that. And that's for the medication monitoring?
Yeah. So for medication, just continue with medication management.
So do you want a medication management a part of this? What that would look like is it would basically just state that, she would be checking in with her PCP to ensure that she's in compliance with her medication.
Yes. As recommended by the provider.
Yeah. As recommended by the provider. If there is medication.
She's not on medication.
Oh, not on medication. Okay. Then if that's the case, then we don't need to add that piece.
That's for sure.
I'm sorry. I got mixed up.
No, I actually think I can. All right. So what we would be doing then is we'd be offering the applicant a consent agreement for 12 months. Every other quarter would be required to submit a hair follicle, as well as continue the therapy twice monthly. Her would have a practice restriction of supervised private practice, and there would be a stayed suspension, and if not signed, denied for unprofessional conduct. Would that be your motion?
And 3 CUs of self-care.
3 CUs in self-care. Would that be your motion?
That is my motion.
Miller, second.
All right. Roll call, please.
Annalisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
All right. So that concludes this case. Ms. Grismore, if you have any questions, contact your investigator. Otherwise, the board staff will be reaching out to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Next case is 7A, Yolanda Baptiste, applicant. Are you here?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Come to the front. Good morning. So first, we're going to listen to a summary of the case from board staff. And then you'll have time to address the board. If you don't mind, can you push the button on that microphone so it turns green? There you go.
Can you hear me now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. This applicant came before us in regards to a substance use issue. And after gathering information, we did send it to a board designee, Dr. Hennigan, for review. What that looks like is our board gets about 1,200 background investigations when people submit their application, but about 99.9% board staff signs off on them as they don't rise to the level of problematic. On a rare occasion, board staff isn't comfortable signing off on it, but we're not sure that it should go before the board either. And so we basically use what we call a board designee. And in this case, we sent it to Dr. Hennigan with her license and experience in addictions. Dr. Hennigan did sign off on this, but after signing off on it, we just received some additional information that we thought was a little concerning and wanted to bring it back before the board. So I'll go ahead and read the analysis here. An applicant for licensure must meet all requirements of ARS 32-3275, which includes the following: A5. Following a review of the investigative record, is not apparent whether there is clear and convincing evidence to support the following violation: ARS 32-3216L, engaging in the conduct, practice, or condition that impairs the ability of licensee to safely and competently practice the licensee's profession. Factors for the board to consider: I also want to note, too, there's a couple of behavioral health issues that I won't be addressing that you have in your analysis. So if you're wanting to talk about any of those or ask questions, we would need to consider going to executive session. Factors for the board to consider: in applicant's 1024 LMSW application, applicant disclosed the following: a 1222 driving under the influence charge, a termination due to her DUI charge, as well as behavioral health issues. Due to the disclosed information, board staff reached out for further information. In a 1024 written statement, licensee disclosed the following: before 2022, applicant did not see herself as an alcoholic. In 2022, however, there were series of devastating losses which changed applicant's life. In 1222, applicant planned to use alcohol to help follow through, leading to her DUI charge. She did not believe she had an addiction. Looking back, she recognized she was considered an alcoholic at the time. While not being fully sober since then, applicant limits herself to one drink every weekend. It is highly concerning that despite acknowledging she had a substance use issue, applicant continues to consume alcohol. And that's all I have at this moment. As you know, there's more information in the analysis, but it basically was the concern that there was a diagnosis of an alcohol problem and the licensee continues to drink on an occasion. So just wanted to bring it before the full members review to consider whether or not you think it rises to a level of violation in a consent agreement, or if the board members want to take no action and issue her license.
Thank you, Ms. Zavala. Do any board members have any questions for Ms. Zavala? No questions? All right. So, Ms. Batiste, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. And just remember that we have read everything that has already been submitted. So, go ahead. You have the floor.
So, I just want to address, my last drink was on March 18th. I've been fully sober ever since. Reason behind it is because my kidneys are failing. Just letting you know that right now, I don't plan on drinking. My wife is actually the beautiful lady in the back with the scooter. She can attest to my sobriety ever since. I would prefer if the board would just grant me this one, hey, you did something wrong, but I have faith in you. You're going to move forward with your licensure and be the best LMSW, LCSW in the future that I can be, because I should have actually brought my supervisors from the past. They've all vouched for me. I've never brought my past alcohol addiction into my work. That is not something I will ever do. I stand firm on that. Reason behind my alcohol addiction, you guys already know, as it's already stated, I have gone through my therapy. I continue to be on my medication. I take it as needed, every 24 hours as it's prescribed to me. I don't use any other substances or nothing like that. This was a one-time incident. I am not the person to drive under the influence, and I'm very disappointed who that person was. With that being said, thank you so much for your time. If you guys have any questions, please let me know and I'll answer it.
Thank you. I also want to thank you on behalf of the board for your service.
Thank you.
The military. And any board members have any questions for the applicant? No questions? Dr. Hennigan, you're leading this discussion?
I am. And again, yes. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Just to have a clarifying question for her. Mm-hmm. March 18th of this year?
This year, yes, this year. Due to the fact I found out on the 14th that I have stage 2 kidney disease.
I think I have a couple of questions that you might need to.
You want
to move to go into executive? Ask the clarifying questions.
Okay.
Left a second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? We're going to move into executive session at 10:39. And Ms. Batiste, you can follow us.
Okay.
Little field trip.
Right, board is back in session at 10:44, and we have Dr. Hennigan. You're leading.
Okay. this one definitely was challenging, but I believe where I sit right now is, you know, I thank her for being here because she seemed to accept responsibility for her actions. During the time that this happened, there wasn't a clinical issue per se. And sometimes life
gives you the best lesson. I think what she's experienced and the consequences she's had, she's in therapy, getting services, she has a support system. She recognizes her triggers. She recognizes consequences of all the things. So I'm okay with, are we okay to do a letter of concern?
There's a variety of things you can do. So you can take, you know, we put it as a not a parent. So meaning that the violation may not be clear and convincing. You can take no action, which means we don't do anything. We can open a complaint and dismiss it with a letter of concern. You can open a complaint. You can offer a non-disciplinary consent agreement, or you can fine for the violation and offer a consent agreement. I think, you know, something to keep in mind is, you know, the board typically likes to see that year of sobriety. And I think that's why we brought this back, because it looked a little bit different. Do you have an issue or do you not have an issue? Why are you still drinking? I think those are things to consider. If you were to open a complaint, dismiss with a letter of concern, it would memorialize the conduct. So if this were ever to come back before the board, that's something that you can consider.
May I add something else that I forgot to mention? The applicant completed her master's in 2023. All right.
I want to hear some input from my colleagues.
I thought I had read somewhere that the original recommendation was an NDCA. Is that correct?
That is correct. An NDCA for a graduate level course in substance use.
If we go the NDCA route, I'm torn, right, with dismissive with letter of concern or NDCA. Like, if we do decide to go that route, I'd want to maybe have something, a CEU of self-care in there, if that's where we choose to go.
I like that route, too. So it's memorialized, and we're still offering some support.
That was kind of where I was headed, is wanting to offer the support we can. I do think the applicant's really sincere in wanting to move forward.
you want to make a motion, Dr. Hennigan? Anybody else?
What? So, then I find for the violation, correct?
No.
Open a complaint?
Open a complaint.
Yeah, open the complaint. I think we need some clarity. Are you still looking at the substance abuse, 3-credit graduate level course in substance abuse? Being that she graduated in 2023, do you want to capture in other CEUs, like self-care and 3 CEUs and or more?
I think CEUs versus a graduate level.
Okay, so 3 in self-care?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what you would do then, based on this conversation, is you would be, you start off with opening a complaint. Open a complaint, offer the applicant a consent agreement for 12 months. During that 12 months, she'd be required to take 3 CEUs in self-care. And if not signed, it would application would be denied for unprofessional conduct. Would that be your motion?
So moved.
Blasio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, motion carries. So that completes this discussion today. If you have any further questions, you can.
I do actually have a question. So what does that mean in the sense of the 12 months? Is it 12 months for once I complete the self-care CEUs at a graduate level, it gets dismissed? Or is it 12 months second from when?
So the complaint's open and dismissed. You can take the 3 CEUs whenever you want. As soon as you take them, you can be released from the consent agreement. But if you could reach out to board staff next week, Monday, we'd be happy to answer all those questions.
Okay, yeah. That was.
But you can move forward with the licensure process.
Okay, sweet. All right. Thank you so much,
all right,
ladies and gentlemen.
Take care.
Thank you.
Next one, we have 7G, Jennifer Rizzo. Do we have the complainant here?
And just for the record, I will need to recuse.
To put it on
her. Oh, Ms. Palacios?
Yeah, I'm not recusing, but I do know the CEO of the agency, and I believe that I can be impartial and biased.
Okay.
Mr. Miller, you're recusing. Okay, Mr. Miller is recusing from this case for Jennifer Rizzo. Thank you. And you're Jennifer Rizzo?
Yeah.
All right, so give us a moment. First, we're going to listen to a summary from board staff.
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the board, following a review of the investigative record, there appears to be clear and convincing evidence to support the following. ARS 32-325116Q, failing or refusing to maintain adequate records of behavioral health services, as well as ARS 32-325116B, using fraud or deceit in connection with rendering services as a licensee or in establishing qualifications pursuant to this chapter. This recommendation is based on the following. From 322 to 724, licensee was employed at agency as a therapist. On 7/2/24, licensee was terminated from agency for falsifying documentation and violating the Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Act. On 6/28/24, complainant called licensee's clients to ask about services being provided, and four of the clients reported not meeting with licensee, yet notes were entered for encounters. Specifically, client AT had eight notes entered by licensee from 6/3/24 to 6/25/24, where the notes included detailed descriptions of a session, making it appear sessions occurred. From 6/4/24 to 6/28/24, client JB had eight notes entered by licensee with details around family members attending the sessions with client JB. And 6/28/24, client AN had one note entered by licensee with a detailed description of symptoms and goals. On 6/27/24 and 6/28/24, client JC had two notes entered by licensee where the notes appeared to be identical. Licensee represented the following. Licensee was trained and instructed by CEO to check in clients who were no-shows and use a previous note for documentation. There was no intent to misrepresent or falsify documentation. Licensee would reload the previous note from the chart or would upload the previous note to an AI system, which would then generate a note that might look differently than the previous. The one-hour duration indicated in notes was automatically generated in the notes. It is highly concerning that licensee fraudulently fabricated notes, making it appear she held a one-hour session with clients when, in fact, they did not attend the session. Furthermore, licensee was using AI software to generate these notes as well without client's consent. Despite licensee representing she was trained to do this, there is no proof that licensee was trained to enter notes for no-show clients in this manner. By fabricating notes, licensee is falsifying clients' clinical records by entering notes for sessions that did not occur. It is unclear if there would be other clients that licensee falsified clinical documentation for, since complainant was only able to contact four of the clients, but based on this pattern, it is highly likely it occurred. Licensee acted in a fraudulent manner by fabricating and falsifying these progress notes. Additionally, from 6/21 to 2/22, licensee was previously employed with Lifeline and was terminated for documentation concerns, professionalism, and not reviewing client charts before sessions. Licensee was also recently terminated from a recent employer for unprofessionalism, inability to meet expected billable sessions, repeated issues with documentation, and poor boundary management. Licensee has displayed a concerning pattern of conduct with a lack of professionalism and inability to document accurately and appropriately. And that is all I have, but I'm going to pass it to Ms. Zavala.
Madam Chair, members of the board, yesterday board staff did upload a supplement, and I would ask that you all open that, and maybe we pause while the members can have an opportunity to review it. I think some of the information in there that was submitted by Ms. Rizzo is important for the board members to see and consider in determining the outcome of this matter.
All right, so we're going to pause for a minute for board members to read the supplement. Are my colleagues still reading?
Mr. Shen's not. I'm good. I was reading other stuff.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Are my colleagues done reading the supplement? All right. So thank you. Where were we? You completed the report?
Yes.
All right. So any board members have questions for the licensee?
Licensee needs to present.
Oh, that's right.
But I did have a question for the board staff.
Okay.
Real quick. What were the findings for? Because I have two, I feel like I either have wrong on my notes or.
It was for 16Q.
Okay.
And 16B.
Got it. Thank you. Just one clarification on that. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So, Ms. Rizzo, you have up to 5 minutes to address the board, and just remember we have read everything that has been submitted.
Thank you so much. Okay. So good morning, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. My name is Jennifer Rizzo. I want to begin by taking full responsibility for the documentation concerns raised in this case. I deeply regret the mistakes I made, and I understand how they violated both ethical standards and the trust clients place in us. I recognize that I failed to maintain clear, accurate records, and that I used AI tools without proper documented client consent. These are serious issues, and I do not take them lightly. I got into this profession to help people, not to harm them. I've been in the behavioral health field for over 10 years. Before becoming a therapist, I served as an executive director for 6 years and co-founded several inpatient treatment centers in Arizona and out of state. My passion for helping others led me to go back to school to become a licensed therapist. I've worked hard for this license.
Take your time.
As a full-time student and single mom, and someone who has dedicated years to the field, since becoming a therapist, I have served hundreds of clients, and many of whom have requested to follow me when I change agencies. However, ethically, of course, I've referred the clients back to the agency. I take that as a reflection of the safety and connection I worked hard to build in my sessions. At the time these concerns were raised, I was still under supervision, and in some cases, I was following procedures as I was trained on, such as checking in clients who no-showed or using AI tools that had been approved by my supervisor. Still, I now know I should have asked more questions, and I accept that it was my responsibility to ensure every practice met ethical and legal standards. I also want to acknowledge that some of my early experience, especially during my internship at Lifeline, lacked proper supervision and clarity. Clients were not informed of intern status, and I was asked to not disclose that I was an intern. I was seeing clients via telehealth during COVID with no oversight, and when I requested to finish my last 2 weeks to complete my internship, I was let go without any warning. Despite these challenges, I've had excellent supervision at other agencies, including Inner Balance and Convianza Health. Supervisors there helped me grow. They gave me corrective feedback and helped me better understand the different modalities and ethical client care. Since this incident, I've completed multiple trainings, developed a remediation plan, and submitted a sample informed consent addendum and a formal statement of intent. I have a hard copy of everything I think you guys had read, if anyone would like it. I also feel it's important to share that on February 14th, this year, 2025, after the concerns the board is reviewing, so that doesn't mean the concerns of the original complaint, after investigating the other two agencies I've worked at, the last place, Inner Balance, had then set their complaints. And so after those complaints apparently had taken place, I was given a letter that I submitted that basically just showed that the supervisor gave me a written card thanking me for my dedication and experience and expressing how happy she was to have me on the team. I've included a copy of that note for your review. I believe it shows that at the time she was still pleased with my work, even after those complaints that she had stated after the review had the request from the board had come. I was then terminated an hour after the board requested for the documentations. And please excuse the fact that I put the board requested my client records. That was just incorrect. Apparently, they had requested my records.
Ms. Rizzo, we're almost out of time. If you can wrap it up.
And the reasons listed in my dismissal referred to events that had occurred prior to that note being written. I shared that this not to place blame, but to offer context and illustrate how I was being perceived before this complaint emerged. I do love this work. I've learned from this experience, and I want to continue growing as a clinician. I'm fully committed to upholding ethical standards and practicing responsibly. Humility and transparency, I respectfully ask the board for the opportunity to continue doing what I've worked so hard to be able to do and help people heal. Thanks again for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Any board members have questions for the licensee?
You said that you had approval to use the AI tool from one of your clinical supervisors. Is that documented anywhere?
No.
Any other questions? All right, no questions. So now this is time for the board to deliberate. We ask that you not interrupt. And Mr. Madera, you're leading the discussion.
I am. Okay, this one's a bit complicated. So maybe it's a good one right before lunch. What are the thoughts of my colleagues here first before I kind of go into my thought process? Because I have a lot going on in my little brain here.
I don't like anything about this. And I honestly, I don't believe the licensee. I think there is clear deception. If you look at the notes, they're documented for an hour apiece. There's, 18 of them total? And any individual would look at those and say, I am billing for an hour of service. And it says, client came in today. Client came into the session with whom? They're so specific that I don't believe they were submitted without her not knowing that it was deceptive. I do want to note that, and I think this, you know, as Lycee was talking about, it wasn't an approved AI. There's no such thing as an approved AI system. The problem isn't that she used AI. The problem is she used it to deceive, and she used it to create notes and falsify documentation. And the reason why I'm so passionate about this is because this is what's happening right now in the system with all this fraud, waste, and abuse. And it's not okay. And it's an abuse of your ability to practice. So I just wanted to start the conversation with that.
And if I may piggyback on that also, you know, with the previous roles that she has held, right? High leadership roles in behavioral health, you know, those elements of clear, precise, accurate, you know, fraud, waste, and abuse issues. I would say that those were common themes in other roles that she has held. That's my concern.
I feel like it's just so minimized that a federal law was broken repeatedly. And in this state where every day you hear the news and there's something about fraud, waste, and abuse, because there's been a lot of that going on lately, as Mr. Shen said, but I don't have any thought that any supervisor, any CEO, any peer, any professional would say, create a note for something that didn't happen and put details as if the person were here. That is clearly a violation of fraud, waste, and abuse. And I think there could be other consequences that come from other bodies because of that.
I also want to highlight, too, the client harm that has occurred as well. If you guys look at attachment 2, there is actually a note from a client that's written that does explain some harm that occurred due to these actions as well. So It's not just harm to the system. We're looking at now, you know, harm to the population.
I think as licensed associates, and this is probably one of my bigger concerns, is I don't see accountability. I see a lot of this was the agency's fault. If it is our responsibility, whether we're licensed associates or not, to understand what we are doing in our documentation. And so if we are working for an agency that is saying this is acceptable, it is our responsibility to not engage in that practice. And so regardless of whether or not this was an agency problem, I certainly believe that the licensee also has accountability in that. And that's my biggest concern, is just lack of ownership of that.
And Mr. Madera, what do you have?
Well, I'd like to thank everybody for their, you know, sharing their opinions. I think I would have had like a 10-minute rant in sharing all of your concerns, because I feel equally the same. I mean, I want to fine for the two, for fine for the conduct, right, of ARS 3232-5116Q and B. And the next part, I have no clue where I want to go.
So that's your, you want to find a violation? Do I have a second?
Getting second.
Oh, and open a complaint. Is that? We have a complaint. Open. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Do I have a second?
Chan, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Next steps. Any comments on next steps?
I would recommend revocation. I don't know. I'm just not okay with anything that occurred in the amount that occurred. So
I have a hard time with this one because of lack of accountability. I'm really struggling with that.
Yeah.
And consistent. This, when you read through the personnel records, this isn't the first agency that has had concerns about this. Mm-hmm. And so we see a pattern of behavior. And so I just have a lot of concern about that.
My concern is the pattern. And if you had higher level positions and you opened up companies and opened up agencies, you've gone through the licensing process to know that how horrific this is. And so there's this, again, the accountability and the pattern. This concerns me.
I mean, reality is it's illegal, right? Billing like this is illegal. It's fraud.
And I just want to know, I know I'm coming off harsh, and I'm not trying to come off harsh. When I sit here and think about if we were to give her a plan for rehabilitation, what would that look like? Well, it would look like, don't be fraudulent. But the problem is, it's already happened. And these people who needed these necessary services didn't get them. So they were sitting around getting nothing. So what was happening? Nothing. And I think at the end of the day, we're hurting people. And that's why I don't feel comfortable with her practicing with the history and just the amount that occurred.
And I would add to that that we look at what's the probability of rehabilitation. And when you're not willing to say, I made a mistake, then how do we rehabilitate that? Especially when you're looking at a pattern of behavior across agencies.
And I'm still thinking about the previous roles, right? The information about adequate billing, clear billing, clear documentation, all of that stuff has already, I would think, has already been in front of the licensee, right? And then you become a master level licensed individual, and the pattern continues, you know? And so it just makes me wonder what happened before she was licensed, you know, what kind of other things that she was overseeing went this way that we don't know.
One, I think the supplemental made me question a lot more, I think, aside from what Ms. Groves mentioned, just screenshots of, you know, and letters from clients and stuff like that. I just think ultimately I would want, is it a consent agreement? For state revocation of license, would that be my?
What direction it's going? If you don't want to have a license, then
voluntary.
And I think that's the struggle we're having right now.
Yeah, and sure. I think just to Dr. or Mr. Shen's point is, of what would the rehabilitation look like? What would we put in that consent agreement? What would help is if we're, you know, looking at these options and weighing them.
Well, and when we look at the like records as well, there's literally a PIP in there, and it talks mm-hmm. about like not fraudulently billing,
right
yeah. in the PIP.
Yeah.
And so that's what a consent agreement would look like, and that to me just doesn't feel okay.
Right. That's I think why I just wanted to kind of put it out there and think of like, well, what would a consent agreement even look like? What would we put in there? And at this point, it doesn't sound like any of us can come up with anything that would be reasonable.
I just can't think of anything that hasn't already been offered. Mm-hmm. And I just have serious concerns about rehabilitation based on what we've read and what we've heard.
And she had the ethics course in December of 2024. And then she had it again in April of this year. So she has... I mean, what we say, you have to take another ethics class, you have to take another fraud and abuse, but she's had it twice.
So she's had the information probably more in this
on many
classes,
levels.
Many levels and different areas. Ms. Zavala, so we go that route of the voluntary surrender. The licensee could apply for a license again and
with that said, when the licensee applies, we would then consider the conduct. I mean, one of the, just hearing you, I mean, I feel like your words are strong and you know where you want to go, and I think that that's fair. But a couple of things to think about, you know, if you were to revoke the license and came back a year or two from now, there's a possibility with rehabilitation you may consider giving her life. One of the options I just thought of like we're all talking is maybe consider a practice restriction. You couldn't practice for a year. And during that time, possibly get therapy or whatever it is you feel that could rehabilitate. And then after starting practicing again, then you have a supervisor who can be there. That's just throwing that out there. I feel you're pretty strong about her not having a license. I think that's based on the conduct. I think that's fair. But I heard a couple times, you know, we can't come up with something that someone can consider to restrict the actual practice and let her take time to work on herself, because if you voluntary surrender her license, a year or two from now, what she's going to have to do is she's going to have to come back and prove to you that she's able to.
I don't necessarily mind that. She's got to come back to us and prove that she's safe and competent to practice in 2 years.
I don't either.
I don't mind the sound of that.
Mm-hmm.
But how would she prove that?
I was just going to make the comment that in order to prove that the person is competent, they would have to be executing adequate information.
We don't look at this conduct, we look at what have you done since. Well, maybe it could be news, maybe it could be therapy, maybe it could be just self-reflection, maybe it could be working at the same place for a year or two with only positive remarks. So we have done it.
Okay.
All right.
You're saying
there's something really important to add.
To see.
Mm-hmm. I do have something really important to add.
Right now it's also to deliberate, so
I just wanted
don't
to
interrupt.
What happened a year ago?
Thank you.
Anything else?
Mm.
We're ready to make a motion, Mr. Madeira.
Well, how do my colleagues feel? Do we feel voluntary revocation or practice restriction? Because now that was thrown in the air, I I want to make sure that I'm on the on what we agree on or think might be helpful. But we can't, unless someone's there 24/7 making sure that all of these things are happening, we can't ensure that there's not going to be any fraudulent activity happening, right? So at the end of the day, it's kind of hard to.
So Ms. Zavala, could we make a motion and then roll call will kind of give us whether people agree or not? So what we could do is you make that motion.
Yeah, let's
we do a roll call.
Let's go with that.
Okay, so that's the motion. Do I have a second?
I have a second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios. Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan. Crystal Krieger. Jose Luis Madeira.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Please
recuse. Yep. Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
Thank you. So motion passes. Ms. Risa, that concludes this section. And if you have additional questions, reach out to your investigator. And they will reach out to you for additional, you know, specific information. Thank you very much for coming. We have next 7F, Jason Packard. Is the complainant here?
Mr. Miller's back.
Mr. Miller's back. Thank you. At 11:22. Thank you. Jason Packard, is the complainant here? No complainant. Is the licensee here? No licensee. Okay, so then we move to a summary from board staff when you're ready.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. We received a complaint on Mr. Packard in March, and at that time it was alleged that he was using illegal substances. Based on that, board staff reached out and asked for him to do a voluntary 10 hair follicle, which he adamantly refused with some emails that appeared to be rather inappropriate, not just unprofessional, but behaviorally unprofessional. With that said, we brought it to the board. We asked for the board to not only issue the 10 hair follicle, but also issue an evaluation for a psychological evaluation. Not only was the 10 hair follicle not completed, Mr. Packard has reached out to board staff, says he's not doing anything that we ask him to do. Therefore, based on his failure to be compliant with a board order, I would ask for the members to consider finding the violation of ARS 3232516N, which constitutes failing to comply with or violating, attempting to violate, or assisting in or abetting the violation of provision of this chapter. Any rule adopted pursuant to this chapter, any lawful order of the board or any formal order, consent agreement, term of probation, or stipulated agreement issued under this chapter. If the board members agree and they motion to find that violation, I would also then ask the board members to consider asking for the voluntary surrender of Mr. Packard's license and if not signed, remand to a formal hearing. That would be two separate violation or two separate motions. Again, the first one to consider finding for the violation of N.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Zavala? No questions. Ms. Groves, you're leading this discussion.
Yeah. I just based on the information that is in this report that we've all read multiple times, I would like to find for the violations. Obviously, best case scenario, it would be great if he would have participated in the things that we're asking him to do, but ultimately he's not, and that's kind of giving us an answer, and we're not really able to move forward with any rehabilitation at this time due to that. Does anybody else have any concerns or comments? Okay. So I would like to find for the violation of ARS 3232516N, failing to comply with a board order.
Do I have a second?
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And then I would like to offer the licensee a consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of his license, and if not accepted, remand to a formal hearing.
Do I have a second?
Dennis seconds.
All right. Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madeira.
Aye.
Dominic Miller?
Aye.
Mark Shen?
Aye.
Brenda Dennis?
Aye.
Teresa Pena?
Aye.
All right, thank you. Now we move to item 7D, Jessica Hedgepeth, and I believe Ms. Palacios, you recuse. All right. So is Ms. Hedgepeth here? No? All right. So whenever staff is ready, we can get a summary of the case.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board, Ms. Hedgepeth was licensed by our board, and in 7 of 24, based on a number of violations, her license was revoked. Board staff received information in March of this year that Ms. Hedgepeth was still practicing. Based on our review of the information that we gathered in our investigation, it does appear that she's still practicing. With that said, we're asking the board members to consider issuing the cease and desist order that's part of your packet in front of you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Zavala?
Well, I have just a random question. I mean, they have licenses in other states too, like something about like Utah and Florida.
Correct.
But
anytime we take action here, it's going to be forwarded over to those states.
Those states, got it. Okay, that was my only question. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dennis, you're leading.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Jose Luis. I was going to say that same thing, as it needed to be on the record that this was in other states. I have read this. I looked on the websites yesterday, and the information is still there. I would definitely move to issue a cease and desist order unless somebody's got something contrary to that.
No, is that your motion?
Yep.
I agree. Second.
Okay. Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Diane Palacios. Recused. Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
Aye.
And thank you, Ms. Zavala. Referring this case to the Arizona General Attorney's Office.
Yes.
We don't have to vote on that, right? That. We do. Okay. So I move to refer this case to the Arizona General Attorney's Office.
Ending in second.
Roll call, please.
Adelisa Meek.
Aye.
Robert Charles.
Aye.
Christina Groves.
Aye.
Lynette Hennigan.
Aye.
Crystal Krieger.
Aye.
Jose Luis Madera.
Aye.
Dominic Miller.
Aye.
Mark Shen.
Aye.
Brenda Dennis.
Aye.
Teresa Pena.
All right, thank you. That concludes this case. And now we move to item 9, applications for licensure.
Madam Chair, can we pause just for a moment?
Yes.
So I'm happy to report that I think that we can get through. We have Ms. Palacios out there.
Ms. Palacios is back at 11:28.
I'm happy to report that I believe the additional information that's for the rest of the meeting is going to conclude by 1 o'clock. And our general rule of thumb is if that happens, we don't normally do lunch. So I guess kind of reaching out to you all, if we want to move forward and see if we can make this happen, or if you're going to want to pause and.
I mean, I've already ordered lunch, but.
It's just, you guys decide. I'm here till 5 if you make me. I mean, I am.
As long as like we can take like a 5-minute break, I'm good with
it. Or do you just want to take a short, I mean, I don't, what time is your lunch coming? Do you know?
11:33 to 11:36.
Mr. Miller, did you order a lunch as well?
No. I ordered it with him. I ordered his.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and move forward
until
their lunch is here. Once their lunch arrives, we can take just a short lunch.
Yep.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Sounds good. All right. So next is.
Bye, guys.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Item number 9, applications for licensure. Ms. Zavala, then denial.
We had 266 licenses issued since our last meeting.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Thank you, staff.
Yeah.
Processing all of those.
Very hardworking staff.
Whoever's ready for denials
can go.
All right.
The Marriage and Family Therapy Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individual and recommends their denial for licensure. One application based on failure to pass the required examination. Total denials, 1.
I have a second.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Council and Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. Two applications based upon a failure to pass the required examination, three applications based upon a failure to take the required examination, and three applications based upon a failure to meet the minimum requirements. Total denials equaling 8.
Do I have a second?
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Social Work Academic Review Committee has reviewed the applications of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. Applications based on a failure, 9 applications based on a failure of to pass the required examination and 8 applications based on a failure to take the required examination. 1 application based on the failure to meet minimum requirements. Total denials, 18.
Palacio, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
The Addiction Counseling Academic Review Committee has reviewed the application of the following individuals and recommends their denial for licensure. 2 applications based on failure to pass the required examination, 13 applications based on a failure to take the required examination, for a total of 15 denials.
For your second?
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Then we go to... We have the financials, Ms.
We do not. We'll need to table those till next month.
Okay, so item 11, financials for April, we're tabling that item. And then number 12, report from executive director and staff.
Yes, Madam Chair. First off, 12A, EBAS, that matter is going to be tabled until the June meeting. Second one is review consideration of possible action regarding board member designees for compliance. So what this is that once we put our licensees on consent agreements regarding whether it's clinical supervision therapy or education, they go to our compliance department and our client compliance department will gather the information from that licensee and it needs to go to a board designee for approval. And so we're looking at making a couple of changes right now. We currently have Dr. Hennigan, Ms. Meek, and Mr. Shen, and myself as the designees. And so what we're looking at changing, and I've already addressed the 3 individual board members, is that Mr. Shen will continue to do the counseling applications. Ms. Krieger will start doing the MFT compliance. Mr. Miller will do the social work and... I'm sorry, Mr. Miller will do social work and Ms. Palacios will take over the addiction counseling. So that's going to give reprieve for Dr. Hennigan and Ms. Meek, who've been doing it for a very long time. And Mr.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Really excited about staying on for a while longer. So with that said, we do need a vote for that. And just for clarity, I've already explained in the email, next week we'll make that transition. There may be some follow-ups with the current board designees. And then as the new ones start getting information for a while, I'll be your key contact, not for the approval, but just on that whole training piece, what that looks like. And we can also schedule a 15, 30-minute conversation of what you need to do. So, and if we can get a motion, that would be great.
So I move that Ms. Palacios, Mr. Miller, Ms. Krieger, and Mr. Shen continue to support the compliance department by reviewing cases. Is that what we need?
Perfect.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
C, update regarding the Counseling Regulatory Board's annual summit. If you all recall, a couple of months ago, we voted that Mr. Miller, Ms. Meek, and myself would attend the Counseling Regulatory Board's annual summit, which is in Austin, fully funded by the regulatory board. It comes to late in the last couple of weeks. They've asked me to do a presentation. And with that, they gave us an extra person. And so I am going to bring the board's deputy director, Courtney Bennett. So pretty excited about that to get her to be more involved nationally.
Yay, Courtney.
Next is the review consideration of possible action regarding Ms. Zavala's participation in co-authoring a chapter regarding regulatory books in the Counselor and the Law 9th edition through the American Counseling Association. Pretty excited about this. So apparently this book is in existence, but they're in the midst of creating the ninth edition. And I was asked to co-author a chapter in regards to the regulatory side of things, which I want to say yes. I do know that at some point they had said there was going to be a stipend for it, which I have declined, mainly because I'm a state employee. But I just wanted to ask, you know, your permission if I'm able to do that. It won't be necessarily from a board perspective. It'll probably be more like an executive director's perspective. But we just now are starting that process, what that looks like. If there's ever a time that I'm uncomfortable or I feel like I need to bring it back to you, I would be happy to do that. But right now, before I even started doing any work or so forth, I wanted to get your permission, and I am asking for a vote on that one.
All right.
Sure, I'll make a motion.
All right.
So I make a motion to allow Ms. Zavala to participate in the co-authoring of a chapter regarding regulatory boards in the Counselor and Law 9th edition.
Rough second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right, motion carries.
All right, we're going to save the rules for after lunch.
All right.
Sorry, guys. Next is G, discussion regarding Ms. Zavala's workplace. I've already spoken to Ms. Meek about this, but thought in all transparency, I wanted to bring it before the board to let the board members know that I plan on working from the state of Oregon in the month of July. Double check with HR, no issues. And just as a fun note, a couple of years ago, the board voted to allow me to work a week a month in Washington, and I've yet to do that. But a whole month is a little different to me, so I wanted to make sure that I let you know. And that leads me to my next discussion, and that's why we moved the board meeting date. And so I have some things I need to tend to there. And so everybody can remember that July 25th is our board meeting date, really important. Sometimes when we change it, it doesn't always get changed on our calendar. So please make sure that you make that change. Next is discussion on best practices on the website. So this is kind of exciting, you know, something that we do regularly as staff, or at least I do. You're always looking at different websites and you're learning at these national, you know, conferences. And I found that New Mexico's counseling board has something on their website, and they call it best practices. And I thought it was super unique. So I shared it with Ms. Meek, thinking, gosh, I think this is something we should consider doing. I think we forget sometimes we're a regulatory board, so we're here to, like, you know, regulate. Well, that's not what we're here for. I mean, we're here to regulate, but I really have a strong mission on educating. And I think if we can put together some best practices, and I'd encourage you again to look at New Mexico's, I think it's really good. Even just best practices on AI, that's something I've added to my list. They don't have it on theirs yet, but it's coming. And so I spoke to Ms. Meek, and I'm going to, the board is going to contract with Clinical Best Practices, Patty DeBratz, to work with me on developing some documents for best practice. And then hopefully over the next, I'm going to say probably 2 or 3 months, going to bring some best practices back to the board for your review and consideration, and then use it as like a working document. So as things come up that we see, we add it to it. And again, it's just best practices. So.
Yeah, like Ms. Zavala said, if you take a look at New Mexico, it's so that we're ready.
It's pretty good. Take a look at it. It's labeled best practices. I thought it was super interesting. I don't think I've ever seen that. But since then, I've found it a couple of other places that, you know, I wasn't looking. So next is the discussion regarding elections. I always like to put this a month ahead. Every June, we do elections for the chair as well as for the secretary/treasurer. Just like to put it out there in case anybody is interested in running during this next month. If you have any questions in regards to, you know, time commitment or wanting to serve, you're welcome to reach out to myself in regards to that. But just like to share, because next month we'll have an election. Don't want people just to show up and be like, oh, I didn't know we were doing this today. So again, if you have any questions regards to that, please let me know. Next is update on the new phone system. So you guys won't see it, but pretty excited about it. We went from, I don't know what kind of phones we had. We went from Cisco, bad phones. No, I'm sorry. We went from Cisco phones to Zoom phones. And it's been a very, very pleasant experience for board staff on many levels. Other than when I forget to turn it off at night, it starts ringing in the middle of the night.
But it's pretty cool. So pretty excited about that, the changes. I think all staff is really excited about the changes. It's made it a lot easier. Often when people were working from home, if their jabber wasn't working that day, you call from your cell phone and you had to hide your number if you remembered. And then people didn't answer because the number was private, and I can just go on and on. So this has been very beneficial, very easy to use. Also very easy to use, being that we are hybrid. It's very easy to add your supervisor or another staff member if you need to. So we're pretty excited about that change.
So is that for cell phones?
No, it's basically on the we have new phones. We have a new phone that sits on our desk at the office, but then which you can answer the phone. But it also, if you're not at the office, you open it up and it's called Workplace. And so you're at home and your computer just starts ringing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're still kind of learning it. I still can't figure out how, when I'm on a meeting and it's ringing, other than pushing decline, how to make it not be ringing so loud. But it's a really great system. We're pretty happy. Pretty happy. So, all right. So now we have the rules, but we're going to need to wait until we take a little break, because the rules are going to be probably at least a 30-minute discussion, if not longer.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the board is break. Do I need to make a motion to break? No.
We don't need a motion, but
board is breaking at 11:41 for about 30 minutes or 20.
It'd be,
okay.
All right.
Till 12 o'clock?
You can try.
Till 12 o'clock. All right. The board is back in session at 12:05, and Mr. Shen has left for the day. We're going to go back to item 12D before we get to the rules.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the board. So last week, I had the privilege of attending the ASWB Educational Committee in Portland, Oregon. Ms. Dennis was there as well as a board of director for ASWB. And so it was, as always, those national conventions are very important for us to attend. In this particular case, because I had agreed to do their admin forum, it was at no charge to the board. I didn't know that when I signed up for that, it was for 3 years. So I'll be participating, with your approval, I'll be participating in their admin forum 2 times a year for the next 3 years at the expense of ASWB. So that is a vote that I'd like to put on the record, but I do want to give Ms. Dennis an opportunity to speak on behalf of her participation there and tell us a little bit about the llama therapy.
Well, first of all, I didn't know that that was a 3-year commitment. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't either.
It's always good to find that out after you say yes. So, yeah, I was lucky enough to be the board liaison to the committee that planned the conference. So it was really interesting. One of the big challenges we had is because ASWB represents both the United States and Canada, we've always worked really hard to make sure that the Canadian jurisdictions are equally represented in the educational offerings, since a lot of the regulatory framework is a little bit different. But unfortunately, in spite of how hard we worked, a lot of the Canadian constituents, as well as the Canadian speakers, pulled out at the last minute because of some of the geopolitical stuff going on. Mm-hmm. So that was a little bit of a challenge. Mm-hmm. But the highlight was llama therapy, as Ms. Zavala mentioned. We were lucky enough to get the therapy llamas that frequently go to the Portland airport, but they came out to the conference and were available for conference participants to love on and get some pictures taken. That ended up being a highlight for a lot of people.
Good therapy. So with that said, I would like a vote to approve me to participate as the administrative forum liaison for ASWB twice a year at the expense of ASWB.
I'd be thrilled to make that motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries for 3 years.
Congratulations, Ms.
Yeah, Paul. Boy, that really speaks to how well respected you are, and the Arizona board is respected by ASWB. So I just want to call that out.
Thank you.
All right, so last but not least on the agenda is going to be the rules. And so this also is going to be an action vote, but it's going to take us a little while to get there. So I'm going to give you a little bit of history of where we're at and where we are, where we came from and where we're at today. So when we go through a rulemaking in the state of Arizona, it is like climbing up the mountain and then climbing a little higher and then a little higher and a little higher. But I feel like we're at the top right now, close to it anyways. And so we've gone through a pretty long process with this. What you're going to see before you today, probably about 70% of it was from our 23-24 rulemaking that ended up failing based on one contested rule. It's still painful, but about 75% of that's still in here. The other portion of it, a lot of it is driven by statute. And then there's some other things that are in here that are what I would consider staff suggestions. And so we're going to go through these. I'm going to go through them as painless as possible, but they're really important. As I always like to share to the stakeholders is that even though we're the regulatory body that in the end makes the decision, that our board cares and considers what the associations want for their profession. Being that we regulate four professions, we have to be very in tuned to what those professions want, what changes they want, what changes they don't like, et cetera. So we submitted this to the Secretary of State's office in March, and it went out for basically public comment. And what that meant was we sent an all licensee email out, letting people know that they could comment. We put it on our Facebook a couple of times. We put it in our newsletter once. They could make comments to us individually through our emails. We also set up a separate email under rules that people can submit to. And so the good news is that we didn't get a whole lot of comments, meaning that a lot of people supported what we did or they just didn't read into it. But I think that the board did a really good job advertising, for the lack of better words, that we were in this process. Because today I'm going to ask for the board members to consider the rules, make a vote. Once you move forward, you know, once we move forward with that vote, it's going to take that next step. And we're going to go to GRC, which is the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. And once they approve it, these rules will go into effect. So if anybody that's listening to this meeting right now or in the audience, please remember that these rules are not in effect now. That's always an unintended consequence. People say, oh, the rule changed. No, the rule has not changed. It won't change until it goes into effect. And at that time, when it goes into effect, we'll do the same thing. We'll send out an all licensee email and we'll advertise it the best way that we can. So what I'm asking for you to do today is we'll go through this. Some of it, you may seem that I might be going a little bit quicker, and it's probably because we have no comments. So there's really no reason to pause unless a board member in the last few months has reviewed something that they had concerns with. I also want to go on record that because of the task that involves the rulemaking, the board did contract with Clinical Best Practice, Patty DeBratz, to work with me on the rule package. I'm getting it all prepared and submitted. It can be a full-time job with all the little little ins and outs that you have to do. So you have in front of you, you have two packets in front of you. One is the proposed rule packet. Looks like this. It's clear. It's not colored. And the other one is general comments. And this one's actually colored. So as we go through this, I think what makes the most sense to me, you all can do it however you would like. I think the most sense is really to focus on the colored one, which is the comments. And then if we have any questions or concerns, we can go back to the rulemaking one. And then just as we go through it, if you have any questions or concerns, you know, please say it now, because at the end, the board members can modify the proposed rulemaking, or they can say we want another month to review it, or you can accept it as is. My hopes is with some modifications, we will accept the rules moving forward. This is very nicely color coded.
Yes. There's like proposed modifications, we say as you go or at the end?
You know, I think that's a great question. I think that if you have concerns, you know, we need to talk it out. if you are all in agreement with the modification, you know, I think just an agreement amongst all of you is appropriate. If you're not in agreement, we may have to take a vote if somebody wants something and somebody doesn't want something. In the past, you know, several years that I've been doing this, I think this is my 7th or 8th rulemaking, and it just gets harder and harder each time. Usually people are usually pretty much in agreement because, again, so much of this is driven by statute, so there's no choice. And then the second piece, you'll find when you get less public comment. We have a lot of very strong, our associations in Arizona are pretty strong. I'm very confident that they vetted through all of these. They're typically going to be the ones that have concerns with the changes. And so you'll see there's just a couple noted in here. And so I think that that's something to focus on too, is, you know, all this work went through. I'm assuming you all at some point maybe have looked at the proposed rulemaking because it's been posted for, I think we're on our 3rd month now. There shouldn't be anything that's a real big surprise in here. But again, let's just go through it and see what works best for all of you as we go through this together, okay? Mm-hmm. So the color code at the top, I think, is really important. So everything that you see in here, every rule that there was a change to, it's going to be in here, okay? If there were no changes, it's not going to be in here. So you'll see the top says identified suggested additions to be made to proposed rules. So that's going to be in blue. Identifies positive in support feedback is going to be in the green. Identifies feedback for additional consideration is yellow. So those are going to be like maybe new rules that somebody wants. And then the red is identifies feedback in opposition of. And again, I won't suggest how you guys consider doing it today, but the opposition is, I think, what the board really needs to be considering and looking at. So the first one here is about 3 years ago. It's crisis response. It's in blue. About 3 or 4 years ago, we had a CPR, which is a very large known agency in the state of Arizona. They came to me directly, and then we came to the board with a possible solution. They had a number of employees that were working for their agency that weren't necessarily doing psychotherapy all the time. They were also doing crisis therapy. And for years, our board never considered crisis therapy because it's an intervention more than the actual assessing, diagnosing, and treating, right? You're assessing it, and then you're often resourcing it out, providing them information. There was a concern if we accepted all 1,600 hours in crisis, what that would look like, because we're not putting out a well-rounded counselor. And so the board on record put in the minutes that we would accept 400 hours of crisis out of the 1,600, or 25 hours out of the clinical supervision. That's been there for, I think we might be going on 4 years now. What has been coming up lately is, what is crisis? And so between myself and Mr. Bratz, we thought that it made sense for us to define it so that board staff has something to point to. Now, I will tell you, if you AI it, you're going to get about 5,000 different definitions. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a right definition or a wrong definition, but it's always nice to have a definition to point to when someone says, well, what do you mean by crisis? So that is... you know, that is what we came up with, that we would like to have it to be considered added to the definition. And I don't know if you guys want to just nod, or if I just keep talking and you're going to, mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm just going to keep talking, yep. And you guys pause if you have any questions or concerns. There was some support in removal of an entity signature. So this is on the informed consent. We all know an informed consent needs to be signed by a client, but this was a removal of the actual entity signing that informed consent. The next one is in pink, and this one's actually a really good one. So this is R46206, and this is change of name, use of name. So this has been in rule this way for a long, long time. And when people, licensees, call and say, hey, you know, I need to change my name, we reach out to them and tell them, you know, if you want to change your name, you have to legally change it. You have to provide us with, you know, your legal name change, whatever that is, a marriage, whatever that looks like. And so we've been saying this all along. It hasn't been in rule necessarily, your legal name, but your use of name. But we've been telling them you need to use your legal name. So board staff felt it would be a good idea, instead of just saying use of name, that we put in use your legal name. And the reason, the purpose of this is, I do think it's important for you to read the opposition piece, but the purpose of it is that we're a regulatory body. So if Ms. Meek decides to change her name to Adelisa, you know, Meek Blanche, and somebody's trying to find Adelisa Blanche, they're not going to be able to find her. Or she uses Meek as her middle initial. And so the reason that we've always told people you need to use your legal name is, as a regulatory board, people need to know who you are. They need to be able to find you on our search engine under our verifications. They need to be able to file a complaint if they want to. They need to know who it is. And so we as board staff has been telling people you need to use your legal name, but it has not been in rule that way. So we're wanting to make that change. And there is some concerns what that might look like. And particularly from AAMFT, this policy, although well-intended, may unintentionally harm marginalized clinicians. And it goes into talking about that. Here's my thought is, I 100% respect what they're saying. And I think, that there may be other individuals out there that may have similar concerns. And I think maybe the board members just consider leaving it as is and letting board staff continue to say you need to use your legal name. And if they don't, they don't. I think our message needs to be use your legal name, but to change the rule to require it could cause, you know, concerns with others. I always share with my staff, and I apologize if my words don't come out very eloquently, but I always tell my staff, you know, you call the licensee by their name. It's going to be Mr. Miller. If Mr. Miller says, call me whatever, then call him whatever. But his license says Mr. Miller, so that's what we're going to call Mr. Miller. So we always are very respectful. We'll call you whatever you want to be called, but your legal name is what's going to be, you know, on your license. So again, my suggestion is maybe we don't change that. Maybe we leave it as is, and hope that the majority out there are using their legal name, so that we're continuing to protect the public by utilizing that. And that's just my thoughts there.
A couple of thoughts, Ms. Avala. The application has legal name on it for licensure, right? So, and I think you said it well, you're being very respectful and you're validating, and there's some awareness from board staff, especially coming from you and Mr. Bratz, about how this can be sensitive. But I don't like when things are misaligned as is, and this calls for more consistency, and I think protects or I think strengthens the rule. The use of name, I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, because in my mind I'm thinking, does that mean use of name requires like notes to be also using the legal name? Is that correct?
So great. I probably didn't do a great job explaining that. So when you fill out your application, you have to use your legal name,
right?
Because we have to prove that you are who you say you are. Mm-hmm. Where it becomes problematic, or could become problematic, is you get your license under Dominic Miller, and then you decide tomorrow or 10 years from now, you no longer want to be Dominic Miller, and now you change your name. Your license is always going to say Dominic Miller on there, because legally, that's it. But using it use-wise on your website so somebody can search you, because if you set up shop and you call yourself something different and they come to our board's website, they're never going to be able to find you.
Makes sense.
They could elude getting a violation. They could dance around.
And I definitely don't think there's intent there. I don't think that licensees change their name or want to use their middle name instead of their last name or their two last. I don't think there's ever I've never seen that yet as an ill intent, but just the concern of, we consistently just say you have to use your legal name because that's what's going to be on your license. We can't change your license. But if you have on your website, you know, something that's completely different than what your license says, they're never going to be able to, you know, so it just felt to me, it felt like protection of the public. They should be using their legal name. I think we may need to be sensitive and just continue to say you need to use it. But if they don't, then they don't.
May I ask a question? Like, so I think you already said the intention of putting this as a proposed rule change, right, that people have to use their legal name, was for that same reason, that people can find you, that is, there's consistency between what you put out there and who you are and your license, right?
Yeah.
So why would we not want to do that?
There's, I think, concern, and I feel as if it's articulated in the comment, mm-hmm. that for individuals who may no longer use that name because they no longer identify with the person or identity rather that they were, and so you're emailing and you're perhaps, you know, marketing, I think Ms. Zavala mentioned, website, this would in essence require that change to be made back to their legal name instead of the name.
Because they're already.
So that.
Not necessarily.
So I think the comments are well taken. I'm just trying to think through, because I agree with you, Ms. Zavala. I think that leaving it alone as it's written here makes sense to me. But that is the concern that I see as valid. And how would we measure the potential impact of this on, you know, maybe marginalized communities? I don't know if there's a way to do that, you know, because there's only the database that the board staff have, and that's the legal name.
I think I also come from a little bit of a different perspective as like being a victim of domestic violence myself. I think that that's the community that I really look at as well as like protecting your identity and maybe who you go by like legally and doing that, protecting your family and your future children and things like that. So I think that I'm more comfortable with leaving this alone than requiring it, because I think there's just too much potential for harm. We do very rigorous background checks on everybody. So, and when we do that, people do provide their legal name and other names that they have gone by. But I don't know if that really needs to be public knowledge, just given the fact that there are a lot of people who would maybe feel like their lives would not be protected.
So it's not the fact that people don't want to provide their legal.
Yes. Yep.
And point of clarification, Ms. Zavala, by leaving it alone, what would that mean?
It will still say. It just says change of name.
Okay.
And again, you know, this all stems from board staff making the suggestion that we use of name. So we're clear, because we tell them on the phone when they call now. And I think we should continue to tell them. But if they choose not to, then they don't.
That's up to them.
And we're not going to hold them accountable. And I think it's a very small few. But as I say all the time, like I hate telling somebody you have to do it this way when I can't point to them where it says you have to do it this way.
Yeah.
So the fact is, we just, you know, continue to say it. But I think that it makes sense mm-hmm. for us to remove that. Again, their license is going to be in their legal name. We're not yep. going to change that.
Right. Agreed.
But we also don't require their license to be posted anywhere either. So, and I don't think it's necessarily a problem. It was more board staff wanting to make it easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I see that. Yep.
Okay. So we would agree that we're going to leave that alone?
I'm in favor of leaving that alone.
Yeah. Next is add language or acquired hours under an exemption. So we had a recent bill that got signed that is not in effect yet. It's HB 2001. And this is actually a really good bill, in my opinion. It's basically another part of one of our exemptions to licensure, ARS 323271. This exemption is going to cover that gap for those who end their practicum and graduate and then can't work until they get their official transcript. So this exemption to licensure is going to say, basically, if you continue to work for your practicum under that supervisor pending the receipt of your official transcript, you can stay there if your practicum wants to hire you. So we've done it kind of twofold. One is that we are the continuity of care for those clients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's huge. But I think, you know, as similarly as important is that applicant that just graduated with $100,000 school loan debt that now can't work because they don't have a license.
Well,
so
I was thinking just kind of behavioral health workforce issues mm-hmm. too.
Well, I would say that that's really common in yeah. a lot of states because I got my initial license in California and I never have to stop working.
Right.
Between that like waiting period, like you were covered for that waiting period as long as you were still seeing a supervisor.
And then the additional piece to that is, which again, I think it's a bill. So what I would ask for you to support is that during that time, if it's qualified supervision, meaning that it meets all the requirements, it can count for clinical, it can count as your hours towards your license, very similar to like a temporary license. So not in effect yet. It will be in effect 90 days after legislative season ends. So it'll likely be sometime in September. When that happens, we will make sure that everybody knows about it. We are in the midst right now, though, trying to stop some unintended consequences because people already think that's in effect. There's emails going out and they don't understand the governor signed it. Why isn't it in effect? It just doesn't work quite like that. So this will happen, but it won't be until September. So if you're doing your practicum right now, this does not count. So with that said, this is the reason that Patty and Mr. Bratz and myself have suggested adding this language because in regards to supervised work experience or acquired under an exemption provided by, as we just mentioned, this new bill, ARS 3232718-13. All right. Next to blue, we have two things that have been suggested from individuals outside. One is that they feel that we should align the general clinical supervision requirements to supervise private practice. That was kind of interesting. I wish in a perfect world we could do that because that would make supervision requirements more rigorous. With that said, I would suspect that that's not something the board is looking at doing. Right? So supervised private practice has more requirements. This individual is wanting the general clinical supervision that you get at an agency or a group practice to be the same. The next one is in regards to wanting more than 15 hours for supervision to be done by the phone. Feels that telephonic supervision has always been limited. So here's something to consider. So this is for clinical supervision hours. It changed after COVID. Basically, you can get all 100 of your hours by video, but still only 15 up by telephonic. That has never changed. My opinion is that when you're providing clinical supervision, it's going to be, you know, I think that dialogue that you have over video is going to be better than on a telephone for a multitude of reasons. And I think that our board has done a really good job making changes with the time where we now allow 100 hours to be online. So, but again, this is not part of the proposed rulemaking package, but it's a comment that was made by one individual.
Not an existing rule.
Correct. That's why I'll start breezing through those because we really, yeah. we can't make changes based on one person, but I also want to make sure that they know they had a voice. Because that's what we were asking for in this process, making sure that they knew that they could, you know, comment. So again, this next one is introducing additional training requirements in practice management and group supervision. And the next is in yellow, identifies feedback for additional consideration. So this next one is to, so this is in regards to clinical supervision training. So the way the proposed rulemaking is right now is that, is it 2027? Okay. Sorry. In effective 2027, when individuals want to become clinical supervisors, they have to go to training. And that's the way it is now. They have to take 12 hours for the first initial time, 6 thereafter every 3 years. I think we can all agree being on the board for the length of time you have, we have an issue with quality clinical supervision. So we kind of dug deep and tried to decipher what can we do to create a better pathway for individuals to get better quality supervision training to hopefully enhance their quality supervision. So what we thought made sense is for us to have what we call a clinical supervision training that's been approved by the board. So this would mean that if Mr. Charles wanted to submit his clinical supervision training that he does, because he's sponsored by somebody, he can come to the board and say, here's my packet, here's my content, here's my CV. Now, board, you review it, and then you're going to pay us $300, which, by the way, we don't need the money, but we don't want everybody applying. We want to make sure they're serious. Gives us a packet. Board staff vets it, and we make sure that what's in the packet is Arizona clinical supervision training and that it meets all of our requirements. We are finding oftentimes people are taking clinical supervision training that's outside of the state of Arizona, and can you believe it doesn't say it has to be in Arizona in our clinical supervision? And so we really feel like this would be a way, you know, kind of twofold. One, we can ensure that the content is accurate. There's not 1 month that goes by that I don't review something that somebody submitted that they're looking at rules from 2015. And then we have them come before us and say they didn't know. And I kind of think maybe you didn't because your supervisor didn't know either. So this would ensure that the content is accurate. And then the addition piece to that, this is, I think, is super beneficial, is now it's going to go on our website. It's going to show that it's an approved training. So when we get two or three calls a week saying, where do I take my clinical supervision training from? And we say, we can't refer to, you know, Google it. Maybe somebody will come up. That's what I tell them. We can go to our board's website. And these are all of the approved trainings. So that is what it is. I'm happy to report we didn't get any opposition to it. If I would have told you at the very beginning of this whole process that there was going to be one contested rule, that would be it. But I think some things to think about with it is it's really a resource. We're providing a resource. The individual doing the training, $300 really isn't much. It's for 3 years. It's not a whole lot of money that we're asking for. We get that quality supervision piece. And then additionally, like, they're not having to pay anymore. We're not adding anything additionally on. So with all that said, the piece that we didn't think about that we would like the board members to consider is that the four state associations, and Mr. Bratz, if I miss something, can you share on this one? Because there was a lot on this one. The four state associations, they have a vetting process, okay? So I can submit to NASW in the state of Arizona, my packet training, and it goes to NASW and they vet through it and determine if they want to sponsor my clinical supervision training. The intent is they're making sure that it meets Arizona requirements. Okay. So now they become sponsored by NASW. And so we think there should be a caveat where it's carved out for the associations. So if it's an association, they don't have to go through our vetting process. So maybe our board approved clinical supervision trainings will have the list of all of the trainings, but it'll also, you know, include, you know, going to those, you know, because we're still going to vet it. So let's just say NASW approves a clinical supervision training. We don't, but they approve it. When they submit their clinical supervision training, we're still going to vet through it and make sure that it meets all the qualifications. Mm-hmm. And the assumption is because it's one of our four associations, it's going to meet. So I really think the board members should consider a carve out for the four associations. And then the second piece to that is that we had one individual, Dr. Seidman, on the phone who spoke up and also wanted to be considered for graduate level courses in clinical supervision at universities. My concern that I have with that is we don't necessarily know that that's going to be Arizona bound. And so I think that that could be possibly a little problematic. Also, I'm not aware of very many graduate level coursework that our clinical supervisors have taken and have submitted it. I don't think that's very common. I know those courses exist out there, but I don't think it's very common. I want to be a clinical supervisor. Let me go take a graduate level course. So again, I think that's up to board members to consider. I think the associations, we really need to do a carve out. As for the universities, I think that there's a concern that we should have that they may not be Arizona specific. And we don't have that relationship with all of the universities like we do with the associations. We're going to trust that the associations know what our rules are, and they're going to make sure that the content's in there.
I agree with you. Sorry. Because they are hiring adjuncts. So somebody in New York may be teaching mm-hmm. clinical supervision, and their basis or their framework is going to be from New York and not Arizona. So
more general.
Yeah, it'll be yeah. very broad and not specific, and we want to try to narrow in and get specific to here.
Ms. Dobrat is raising her hand.
Two things that I would just add for the board, and as you guys reviewed, you might note a bit, only Toby highlighted, the other change with the clinical supervisor training would be the 12-hour right now could be asynchronous, so it could be an on-demand training, and the rule change would require that to be done live, so either live webinar or in person. Mm-hmm. So it could still be done online, but having it be live, so I think that's a change to note. And then I don't know if you were going to speak to this one, but the other comment in red came up from AMFT. The original proposed rule change would eliminate the national credential for a supervisor taking the place of the 12-hour training. AMFT raised some concerns about eliminating that designation from counting. And so there was some feedback about still allowing like the AMFT approved supervisor standing, et cetera, to take the place of the 12-hour training. And I don't know if you want to speak to that, Toby, because I know you kind of looked into that too.
I'm not sure. I'm on the fence with this one. And so I think that I understand their thought process, because I think, how many hours is it? 30, 40? So basically these individuals go through this 30 to 40 hour clinical supervision training to get this, you know, very high, you know, level certificate, you know, for their clinical supervision. I don't think there's as many out there as we wished that there were. But I also have concerns. I believe that if you're a clinical supervisor and you go to that much work to get this status, even though it may not be Arizona specific, I think that maybe our tutorial could possibly cover the Arizona rules and laws.
I would agree. Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I just feel like it's a pretty high level, you know, I mean, they might miss a few things, but again, because you're going to, when we get to the clinical supervision, you know, if you've looked at the proposed rule, there's a few additional clinical supervision requirements that we want in those trainings. And if they miss it, then they're going to, you know, then that could be problematic. But I just feel like you go through that much effort to go through that much work that I'm hoping that you're going to be one of those qualified supervisors out there that we're wanting. And so I know Mr. Miller said he agreed. I don't know how the other feels about that.
Especially because we have the Arizona clinical supervisor tutorials. Well, if we didn't have that, I'd have more hesitation.
And once all the rules go into effect, you know, both the renewal tutorial as well as the clinical supervision tutorial will be updated based on the new rules. And just like we always do, and probably even more, we're going to educate as we go through this process to make sure that everybody knows what's expected. So.
Toby, real quick on the back to the board approved. Do you anticipate that having any additional admin burden or bandwidth issues on the board if you're going to be approved, your staff are approving the clinical supervisor trainings?
Yes.
I know. So like, I'm just calling it out because I.
So my hope was, I mean, you know, it's definitely something that, you know, I would be tasking myself with, you know, as a qualified individual, but I think when the time comes, depending on the amount, it could be something that we could have another board designee. We could even, do another subcommittee. I mean, there's things that we could do right now. As far as my thought process right now is I will do that task. But as it comes forward and we see how many are submitting and what that looks like and how cumbersome that is, then, maybe we can consider, assigning to a board member, those types of things.
Okay. And would the board staff have flexibility to perhaps contract if needed to somebody to do that? Okay. Just wanted to make sure I said that because I see a growing administrative requirement, but I think it's a good change.
Thank you.
And Ms. Zavala, we would be approving the content, right? Not no matter who's teaching.
Well, I mean, my thought is that we would be approving the content. I mean, they would, be required. This is something we'll develop a policy or a procedure of what that looks like. But I would imagine they submit their CV and the content. I don't think we want, just a random person providing clinical supervision training to our licensees. And so that's something, if this rule were to pass, which I think that it will, it's something that we're going to need to consider. What does that look like? And it doesn't mean necessarily that the training is, I mean, it still might not be a good training, but at least we will walk away feeling like the board did what we could do to make sure that the content was in there.
Would we be able to add some type of, well, this is my opinion, a caveat of the somebody needs to be licensed or independently licensed to teach this? Because maybe if somebody has an MED, right, and they're wanting to teach, but they've never been they've never been licensed. So that's just something that I'm thinking about.
I just answered real quick. I think that's a great question. I think what we end up doing, as the rules get closer and looks like we're happening, that could be a discussion that we can have. That does not have to be part of the rule. The rule is just going to kind of tell you what it's going to be. And then we'll come back with a, kind of like supervised prior practice. This is what it needs to look like. It has to be this. It has to be those types of things.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, part of me thinks to myself, I'm sure they're out there, but how can you teach clinical supervision training when you're not a clinical supervisor or ever have been?
Right. That's my thought exactly.
That's why you're
so I do think those are things that we'll definitely, dig into a little bit more what that looks like, but I think that's a very fair point. And I'm also in, I also think the members are really going to have to consider, like, I'm not sure that we want, psychologists and MDs and, nurse practitioners teaching the course. They've never gone through it themselves. Mm-hmm. So, but that's something that at the end, you guys can make those decisions. I will have opinions, of course, but. The next is R46217. Again, this was just an individual wanting additional. Because reviewing the policy that allows associate level providers with minimal experience to establish supervised private practice may help balance access to care with the need for adequate training, require a more substantial period of supervised work with an established entity before operating independently could support higher standards of care. I think this all goes back to this individual person, clearly probably has concerns in regards to supervised private practice and making sure people know how to own and operate a business. So the next is, or just some comments, and I'm going to kind of, because we're not getting short on time, but I'm not sure that these comments, some of these comments are in statute, we can't make any changes. Somebody's in support of SPP owner, somebody else that's in support of SPP. So under endorsement and universal, the two blue ones here. This is something that I would like to be added to the rule. So we have our two pathways to licensure, endorsement and universal recognition. Universal recognition is a law, so we do it. It is on our website, but we really don't need it because our endorsement is so robust. Basically, if you have a license in another state for 1 year in the same profession at the same level, you can either be a resident of Arizona or a resident of there and you're going to get a license. But what it doesn't have in there is you have to take the required national exam. And I have concerns with that because there has been some states that have chosen to eliminate the ASWB exam for licensure, or they've provided an alternate path. pathway for applicants to come through and not take the exam, and I don't want them licensed in Arizona. It was never a problem in the past for us, but it's just become of late that they're eliminating it. And so I'd like to add that they have to pass the national exam. Like I said, never been an issue before, but that way when those individuals that have chosen not to take the national exam to ensure their competency, that we don't have to give them a license via endorsement. And if they want to apply the regular way of licensure, they would have to take the exam. So I think that this is really important for the protection of the public. And right now it's just the ASWB exam, but it could be the addiction exam next year. We don't know. So across the table, the national exam. And then on the temporary license, so this is interesting. So y'all, does everybody here know what the temporary license is? So basically, you know, once the way we had it was once you graduated within 12 months, you could apply for a temporary license. This would allow you to practice, to start acquiring hours. We did some thinking about this and processing, you know, not just with Mr. Bratz, but with board staff, and said, why? Why does it have to be within 12 months you graduated? Why can't it be that you graduated 16 months ago? Why does it matter? And maybe, I mean, maybe the clinicians here will have a different thought there, but you graduate in May from whatever program you graduated from, and life happens. And 14 months later, you decide to apply for a temporary, and we say, sorry, rule says it says 12 months. Why? Because and even if it's been 2 years or even if it's been 3 years, why? Because we're going to make sure that they take the exam and pass the exam, which is going to be to show their competency. So there's Toby by a lot of these, but Toby thinks that we should remove this qualification. It doesn't happen very often. But that, you know, once every month when somebody calls, probably once a month, probably 12 times a year, somebody will call. Well, I graduated 13 months ago and I took time off because I did X, Y, and Z. And we're like, sorry, you don't qualify. So really would like the members to consider removing that.
Yeah. If we remove it, would we want to do any time frame at all? Like if someone's like 10 years from
That's
now.
What I was saying, right? I mean.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's up to you. If there's any concerns there, I mean, we could put a time period. It doesn't happen often. I will tell you when it does, it's normally like less than 2 years. It's like, it's just that person. It's that person that graduated, didn't know what they wanted to do when they graduated. And then, oh, I got to take the test. And then they come back. You know, I think if you wanted to put a time frame on it to change it, we could do that. I just not sure what the purpose of it was.
I think because it's still, hopefully the information is still fresh or your practicum is still fresh if you had an internship. But
I don't really know, I guess, what the purpose of that was either, because when I moved to Arizona, I had a temporary license, and that was because I was waiting a year longer until I could do license via endorsement, right? And so that was extremely helpful to me, but I don't understand, I guess, the 12 month from graduating type deal, because I just don't know who's going to be applying for a temporary, especially let's say they've been licensed somewhere else for 2 years. They're going to go to the endorsement.
What Ms. Groves is referring to is there's two reasons why you can get a temporary. One is if you've graduated in the last 12 months, and the other is if you're applying from out of state pending licensure. Very few people nowadays apply for a temporary because apply for a temporary from out of state because our endorsement is so robust, we're issuing them within a matter of a couple of weeks, unless they haven't been licensed in their state for a year yet. And so they get a temporary waiting for that to happen. So that definitely is it's a little different. This particular one is about that person that graduates. And I don't know. I mean, again, I'm not a clinician, but I just ponder my, because if you got to take the exam,
you still have to take, yeah.
That's going to show your competency.
Yeah.
And I also think it's a very few amount of people.
Well, and doesn't the temporary license require that you work for like an agency? Like you can't go out and get a private practice.
Correct. Yeah. You can't be in supervised private practice. Yeah. You can work for a group practice or an agency, but you can't be in supervised private practice.
And how long can you have the temporary for?
1 year.
1 year.
I mean, if they're going to apply for it, my thought process is they're aggressively trying to take the test, get the mm-hmm. license, and do all the things.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to. The time frame doesn't really make
sense. It's not like we renew temporary licenses, right?
Yeah, they're going to lose
it. It's only good for
correct.
A year.
It's only good for one
only
year
good for
total.
A year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel more comfortable about that after the discussion. Okay.
I'm good, Toby.
Then the next one in green is part of the rulemaking process, and this is probably one of my favorites. So right now, the way the rule is if you have a temporary license, we issue a temporary license, you're going to get a letter in the mail telling your temporary license is good for 12 months, and it's also going to tell you you can take the exam. You have to take the exam within 12 months. That's what it's going to say. It's also going to say you have 3 attempts to take the exam. But if you have a temporary license and you fail the examination on the first try, your temporary license is expired. Why?
Ouch.
No.
Change is good there.
So we want to change that. And this is part of the proposed is that why does it matter? We're going to give you a temporary for a year. You have to pass the examination within a year. Mm-hmm. If you fail the exam the first time and you take it again, you fail it the second time and you take it again and you pass it, you get into your regular licensure. If you pass it all, if you fail all 3 times or you fail one and never take it again, your temporary is going to expire.
Yeah.
Took 15 years to come up with that. All right. The next one is just memorializing the board member's decision. No more than 400 of the 16 hours of direct client contact can involve crisis response, hence our definition. Next one was just an error. There's 9 core content areas in the counseling, and it said 8. Again, the next one is for the same, the 4 of the 1600. I won't repeat those. And then marriage and family. So there's quite a few curriculum changes that happened there. And, you know, that's not something that the board ever does. That's going to be the association. So in preparation for the rulemaking process, you know, the Marriage and Family Association came and said, hey, we want changes. We said, great, give them to us. They went a step further, and not only the Arizona chapter put it together, they also got it approved nationally. So again, you know, I wouldn't say they're minor changes. There's definitely changes to the curriculum, but nothing that is a burden to licensure. And it's, again, supported by not only the state association as well as the national association. Do you want to speak on that at all? Do we need to speak on that at all? Okay. Then we did have one comment in yellow, request change in language. So this is in regards to the curriculum for marriage and family. Change in language for practicum from 2 semesters to 12 months. And this, you know, was the concern was regarding other state requirements may not align. So which I appreciated that is that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when they get licensed here and they go somewhere else, we want to make sure that they meet somewhere else. And this individual thought that that might be problematic. So we paused in the middle of our public hearing on Tuesday and got some feedback from AMFT. And they represented that this was viewed by AMFT, and the organization believes there are only a few states where this may be a concern, and they did not share in the request for the change. And so, you know, based on that, an association not in support of the change, I would recommend the board members not make that change. The yellow, there was a typo that was changed. The addiction counselors, there was a recommendation of a change to social and cultural. That was for their cultural diversity class. I think I might be saying that word wrong, but just to change it to social and cultural, no other changes, just the name. All right, so now I need to go to 801C. I actually need to look this one up, 802C. So this is just a recommendation for clarification, and I always appreciate these. because I think when we see this all day long and we carry our rule book around like I do, everything just looks fine. But then when somebody brings it up, you start questioning if it's okay. So right now, this is under the continuing education 802C. And right now it says a minimum of 3 clock hours of continued education sponsored, approved, or offered by an entity listed in subsection D. And then it has the three listed. I think it makes sense to put in each. That's really kind of, it's not really a, I think it's just a clarification. You'd be surprised what we get. Where does it say each? It's like ABC, but it doesn't say it. So I think anytime we can add that one word to make a difference is good. Okay, so then I think this was a really good one too. So this was made by one individual. Did we, I feel like I'm lost on this one, Patty. I'm sorry. Did we agree?
Yes. So it's in regards to the new 3 CEs in technology.
Okay.
Again, just clarifying that technology could, like the training could apply to any of those topics that are listed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to cover all of those topics.
Anytime you can clarify something in rule, it's for the better.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And here's the other piece to that. So this is real important for the members to know. So this is part of our proposed rulemaking, but it's in addition to. So right now we have our 30 hours. 3 hours is the tutorial. 3 hours is the cultural competency and diversity, which now is going to be changed to cultural considerations in psychotherapy. And then the third one is added. So 3 hours in the technology related to behavioral health, such as the importance of that is so important. I'm not sure there's one person out there that has never done telehealth. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't do it regularly. And so I think that the board, again, this is an addition, but it's not an addition to the 30 hours. But the one thing that we noted after Tuesday is that there was no effective date. And that's what you'll see in blue, that we need to add an effective date of 1/1/27. And this is for the board to get the word out. When you renew after 1/1/27, you have to take a course, and it can be in any of those, and we'll spell it out a little bit better there.
Just to clarify, the use of or versus and could read that technology could just focus on AI and behavioral health, right? So I just wanted to make that clear by replacing and with or. You give flexibility. So if you were intending to make sure telehealth and electronic communication were covered, then use of. Or use of cleared it up. Thank you. I wasn't seeing that, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's what it was, just to give that flexibility of.
Not and use of.
Correct.
Got it. Thank you. There.
The next one's a suggested addition for the consent for treatment. So this individual included a paragraph from their previous state's rule. You have the statement in context, but it is bold and underlined part that I think would be good to add to our informed consent requirements. Any individual licensed or certified under this act or in accordance with the Interstate Compact for Licensed Professional Counselors is required to conspicuously, because one of my words, display a professional disclosure statement at his place of business or at the principal location where his services are performed, and to provide a copy of the statement to each adult client or in the case of a minor to the minor's parent or guardian before or during the session and upon request. If the board is interested in including something to this effect, it may be appropriate to consider how this could be incorporated into the proposed language for R461101J, the professional nature of the relationship. So this is an interesting one. So we haven't gotten there yet. Let's pause on this one, and then maybe somebody will remind me to come back to it when we get to 1101, because I think that that's an important we're in 1101, but I want to talk about the description of a professional nature of a therapeutic relationship. So this This is actually part of our proposed rulemaking. And I had to ask the question several times. So in your informed consent, there would be an addition, and it would be a description of the professional nature of the therapeutic relationship. I think that the board should consider doing this. It's part, again, it's already part of our proposed rulemaking package. We did get a lot of questions through our rules inbox, as well as at the public meeting. What does this mean? Is anybody here is asking that question? What does this mean? So the intent behind it is that 80% of our disciplinary matters are boundary related.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the intent is that if you have an informed consent, whether it's an agency or a group practice or an individual practice, that you're going to put something in your informed consent so your client knows that you can't have sex with them. So your client knows you can't be friends with them. And I say that, and I use that as an example, because when we get those egregious boundary violations, it's usually not from the client. It's from the new therapist, because the client doesn't know that it's not okay. And so I do think, I think this language works, but when and if the rule were to pass, I think that the board is going to need to do a really good job. What does this mean? What does this look like?
Yeah.
And it just basically a paragraph that denotes your relationship.
Under our best practices section that we're going to have, we give like a little blurb, like here's a sample of what. No, they don't have to use it, but at least they have a foundational.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. I've actually already made that note, and I didn't make that note until we had so many comments and questions. Like, what does that mean? But then when we talked about what that means, we got a lot of heads nodding, like, okay, that makes sense. I just don't know what other language to say, description of the professional nature of the therapeutic relationship. Well, they're my therapist, but no, we want something in there that tells the client that we have boundaries and we can't cross those boundaries. And we might be surprised. That could be, it could be game changing.
Even for when they're, if you're in an agency, like you're not seeing two family members. Mm-hmm, so they,
right.
those are outlined in it too. And maybe it's a section you just initialing down, like, I understand this. I understand this is the boundary that this is specifically. I mean, I think it would be a game changer for what we see. Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
As long as those best practices and the support is given, I think I would agree with you.
Yeah.
Oh, but I think one of the parts of the thought process when we were talking about this and developing it was also not giving too scripted language either, because in my time serving on the board and as regulators, thinking about it's important for therapists to think about and be mindful of how would I describe that, right? What do I want to put in my informed consent? Not just copy and pasting
yeah.
a scripted language. So I think it's twofold. I think we give suggestions and the best practices, but also it's good for the therapist to think about what does this mean to them.
So kind of like instead of that scripted paragraph, more of like ideas such mm-hmm. as, ideas yep. such as. So.
Yeah, and the feedback that you got, were they pretty similar questions?
Yes. Well, a lot of it was, what does that mean? And how do you do that?
Yeah.
And what does that look like?
Okay.
And so that made me make a note when that is to happen, we need to do a really good job making sure that it's more clear, because I don't think we can get any better language than that. I think the language is somewhat clear, but
mm-hmm.
I know if I was putting it together, I'm not sure where I would go with it, but I think we can definitely get some ideas of, you know, under our best practices, what that looks like. So. There was also some questions in regards to being more clear about the use of AI element, and we got some suggested language that I think works really well. Proposed new language, notification of any, so this will be in our informed consent again, notification of any form of AI, machine learning, deep learning, and or other human simulation modality used to provide, record, and or document clinical services. And I won't read you what we had before, but this is much more clear. So we, Patty, Mr. Bratz and I inadvertently took out a couple of things. We took out obtain a date and sign signature. So we'd like to add those back in.
Mm-hmm.
Um,
So we had a suggestion. I would suggest that the rule be modified for treatment planning and telehealth as well. For example, the plan could be created and renewed with the client, with them providing their verbal consent to the plan, indicating that they understood. I think for the safety of the public, that's not something the board members would want to consider. In the state of Arizona, there is a statute that allows you, if you're only providing telehealth to a client, you can get a verbal consent. If I was a clinician, that wouldn't work for me because that's a verbal, so it didn't happen. But it's a state law, and so we do allow for that. So if they're doing telehealth only with that client, it can be a verbal consent. This individual is wanting it to also be for the treatment plan. Again, I think that's very problematic. And I respect it and understand where we're going, but we need to make sure that things are being signed and understood by all. The next one was in regards to when to develop a treatment plan. So the current rulemaking process, we added in after the fourth service, there needs to be a treatment plan. We got the call a lot at the board, when do I have to develop a treatment plan? Well, when do you talk about the treatment plan? And respectfully, I hope most of the time it's not the first, but I also know sometimes it is the first in certain agencies to bill. But we also don't want to see the 7th and 8th and 9th and 9th month and 10th month. And we saw one not long ago, it was 7 years. So we had put in 4 because that seemed to be kind of a standard. And we had a couple of feedback that had suggested, one had suggested every 6 weeks, which didn't quite make sense because you could be seeing them. And then there was a couple that ended up with the 5th session. And so we would recommend that we change that to the fifth session instead of the 4th.
We would recommend that as
well. Yeah, our proposed rulemaking says 4. You have to do a treatment plan, and this would be changed to 5.
Okay. I just kind of feel like that's excessive, honestly. 5, like, I mean, most, like, quite a few boards and just in general, most agencies are requiring you to have it done by the 2nd or 3rd session. So I think 4 is plenty. I think 5 is a lot.
And can maybe we do a time frame instead of number of sessions? Because what if some, and then we haven't discussed what is the frequency maybe of sessions?
So if somebody drops once off a month. Yeah, when off and they never get a treatment plan.
If you're meeting with somebody once a month, that could possibly be 5 months until somebody signs a treatment plan. But what if we do something more about within the first 90 days?
Mm-hmm. But what if they come see you and then they don't come back for 3 months or 4 months?
Well, then
that's why the sooner the better.
Yeah, you're still.
Yeah, you document it and do a new treatment plan when they resume service.
Just to clarify, in current rule, there's no time period. The original proposed rules was the 4th session. The feedback that we're getting is the 5th session, and the majority of that came from those that practice EFT, including the Arizona Association for EFT and AMFT, due to being able to assess multiple subsystems or have your individual sessions as well, and so to complete that comprehensive assessment and then complete the treatment plan in that 4th or 5th session. And so they had asked us to extend to the 5th session to account for that.
Why don't we do a time frame?
Well, I think
that sounds better.
That point, I think you have people that we know how hard it is to come in and then they disappear for a couple months and then they come back. And
yeah.
But I have a question. So to have more sessions in order to complete certain assessment, is an assessment part of psychotherapy? So couldn't that be part of the treatment plan?
So you could do an interim treatment plan,
yeah.
Right? You know, but mm-hmm. We're talking about what are we regulating versus best practices,
right?
I mean, it's just the Ms. Groves point too. I mean, best practice, I think, is for every session before you have a treatment plan, your plan section says continue to assess and develop treatment plan, but I don't know how specific the board wants to get in that.
So would that be congruent with what the payers, you know, I'm thinking Access or kind of the major payers, what their requirements are?
Payers are going to tell you the first session.
Yeah, they are.
And ultimately, like, best practice is if somebody disappears for 3 months and they come back on my caseload, we're developing new treatment plan goals anyway.
Definitely doing a new one, yeah.
I don't know if it answers the question, but you could use some legislative language that usually it gives constraints. So whichever comes first, this period of time or this many sessions.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
that would, like that too. That would build some flexibility in, because I don't like the idea of waiting 5 months or
so. And I think this discussion is based upon a few specific modalities, right? And so to make a rule based off of just one or two or however many modalities, I think we need to be more general. But I like Mr. Charles's suggestion.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion, because ultimately, you know, basing it off of a couple modalities really isn't capturing the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they could do an interim treatment plan, right, for those certain modalities in order to meet that requirement. We're just not capturing the entire population of our board.
So what do you want that to look like?
I would say 4 at the 4th session, or what period of time?
I mean, if we're going to say,
I would say 30 or 60 days, or maybe even 30 to 45.
Is like 30 to 45.
I think 90 interim. Is way too long.
I do too.
And an interim treatment plan would solve a lot of these problems for some of these individuals.
Because the interim treatment plan could say return for next session to complete,
right?
You know,
continued assessment, or
just because you're going to have people in crisis, and then we're going to have someone come before the board, like, oh, we're going to have the treatment plan for 45 days, and guess what? On the 40th day, they had a suicide attempt. And then the clinician is on the hook because, well, what did you do? Well, I didn't have to have a treatment plan. I just did the assessment.
So, Ms. Dobritz, would that time frame of 30 to 45 would allow, like, either come in on a regular basis to complete those assessments?
Are you asking me in terms of my process or the feedback that we got from AMFT and the Arizona Association for EFT? I believe the feedback would be the same from them, that they would want more than a month, because even if you're seeing weekly, the 4 sessions, their feedback was that 4th session wasn't enough. So again,
that's just the smallest population. It's like likely people who aren't even billing insurance, right? Because if you're billing insurance, your treatment plan happens first session.
Mm-hmm. I will say, as you guys talk about the language, what I would consider and give us direction on is some of the feedback initially with how it's written with by the 4th session, or have to look exactly. Some people wondered if it could be completed during the 4th session. So I think as you think about this language, is it by the end of the 4th session, or within 90 days, whichever comes first, however you want to word that. But that was some other feedback that came up too.
Because it says by the 4th session.
But then we could say
by the end of,
right? During the first 5 sessions.
I guess it would be like, what, within 30 within days or 5 by 4 sessions, whichever occurs first, would be what you would go with. So if it was by 30 days, right? So and you only saw that person twice, then you would need to have
within 30 days or by the completion of the 4th session.
Yes.
Whichever comes first.
Yes, whichever comes first.
Can you say what you said, Mr. Charles? Because your language was better.
Yeah.
That's how I am all the time too.
But it was recorded, so
it's recorded. Yeah, I'll listen to it.
So are we saying 4th or 5th session?
I'm against the 5th, but I don't know.
I'm just like, one more session.
What was your original
4th?
What was your reasoning behind that?
The reason for coming up with it was because we were having people come before the board on their 7th or 8th or 9th or 10th session with no treatment plan. And they're like, well, where does it say you have to be done by a certain number of time? And I think that's something that I appreciate that question, because when we make changes, we really have to think about, who does this affect? What does this look like? I will tell you, the majority of the treatment plans that we see, and we see a lot, are signed way before the 4th. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so maybe there's a group of individuals or group MFTs, maybe in certain family, you know, type settings, maybe it may take a little bit longer. But I will also say, if it ever comes to the board and it took place on the 5th session or the 6th session, and we could prove all that, it's not going to be an issue. So we're really just trying to provide guidance. If the 5th session is going to do more harm than good, then I think we stay with the 4th session. And if you happen to be somebody working with a family and it takes you the 5th to the 6th session to develop a treatment plan, and it happened to come before the board, we're not going to take issue with it.
It's those that just decide, we don't need to do treatment plans. We had somebody in front of us a few weeks ago that said, or a few months ago, said they didn't know the benefit of a treatment plan. So it's really just a guidance, you know?
Yeah, I think I'm still struggling with it a little bit just because it's very specific to a modality. Whereas when we're doing intake and seeing clients, like, they're going to want to know what their goals are pretty much right away. And they're going to want to know, you know, what is this going to look like? What's the frequency going to be? I think that those things are important to be discussing right away. And even when I'm doing consultation calls, well, how often are we going to meet? You know, that's one of the first questions I get. And so I say, oh, we'll discuss it at the first session, you know, and we'll do your treatment plan, explain the process. But I think it's where is this rule based upon certain modalities? And because, and again, I am not certified in that modality. So I, you know, I'm just looking at it from, like Ms. Grove said, it's a very small population.
Well, but if you think too about the intent of putting that time frame in, I feel like should make a little bit of a difference. I would suggest by the completion of the fourth session, again, it's a rule. So I don't want to say it's guidance. It's a rule, and that's what we're going to tell you. But if we happen to have a case that comes before the board and it didn't happen until the fifth session, that's not, you guys have seen it. That's not a problem. You because you can read right through the clinical records why it took you that long.
Well, for example, you know, like, let's say somebody has a crisis and they're suicidal and you're managing crisis and you don't get to the treatment plan until session seven because all you're doing is crisis management. Okay, well, that makes sense. It should just be documented in the chart.
But you still could put in an interim treatment plan.
You could. Yeah, yes.
That's my thought, is keep it simple. Let's keep it to four sessions. Mm-hmm. And really best practices, if you are doing an evaluated process, you should probably have an interim treatment plan in place in the meantime.
But we should say that because we see people have documentation problems all the time.
Yeah.
And so if you give them five sessions, guess what? They're going to take five sessions. Or guess what's going to be? Oh, well, we were still doing crisis management, so we had to wait to the sixth session. I don't think it's.
So we want to just do by the completion of the fourth session.
That's what I think.
Yeah, I just want to make one quick note. The reason why it's not concerning to me is because there's more stringent rules in Title IX. I know that's not what we're talking about, but the majority of folks or individuals receiving behavioral health treatment in Arizona have to follow licensure rules that are more stringent than that, and that is 24 hours. And so we're talking about not the majority. We're talking about those that wouldn't fall under those other statutes. So there is a minimum standard that is more stringent out there.
So we're doing the four sessions
by the completion thing, or just by the completion of the fourth session?
That's my thought.
Which is what you had originally?
We had by the fourth session, which I think was unclear.
Oh, okay.
By the fourth session, that to me means when they walk in their fourth session, that should be done. So this would be by the completion of the.
Okay. Can we just clarify for the record too, for those listening or here, you don't only do one treatment plan, like you're not one and done. And so I just think, like, we're putting parameters on it, but like, what's clinically appropriate?
Minimum best practices, right?
Okay. I have one more question on that. I'm so sorry. So does that cover the people who, for example, let's say they're seeing somebody monthly, and so we're going 4 months without a treatment plan potentially? Like,
yeah, this is just a guidance. Again, okay. What we see generally is going to be the first or second session. Generally, that's what we see.
Okay.
There's also a client risk in treatment planning too soon without doing a comprehensive assessment. So I think we want to be really mindful of that as well. So
yeah. Your treatment plans are living, reading documents. So you are, in a sense, you're always updating.
Yeah, I agree.
They have, whether we call it interim, the regular treatment plan.
Oh, what you want.
It has to be something in place to drive treatment. You need a rope.
Yeah, very important.
And the last comment was something that's in statute that can't be considered. So with all of that said, I would ask for the members to consider a motion to adopt the final draft of proposed rulemaking with the modifications. In other words, what was discussed.
You mentioned wanting to go back to 1101.
Yeah,
good.
Oh, sorry. Well, I actually did. We were already in 1101 and I got myself out. That was the whole
professional therapist relationship.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
So, I think, you know, Mr. Cross had commented in there some additional language that he thought we should do in regards to, you know, making sure some additional statements. I think that the additional therapeutic relation portion really takes care of that piece.
Okay. But this is about the interstate compact. Is that the one that you?
Well, it's about adding. All right. So any additional licensed or certified under this act or in accordance with the interstate compact for licensed professional counselors under states the number is required to display a professional disclosure statement at his place of business or at the principal location where his services are performed, to provide a copy of the statement to each adult client, or in the case of a minor, to minor's parent or guardian before or during the first session upon request. So, I mean, we don't do field visits, so we'll never be able to monitor if it's there. And I think it's also, you know, suggesting that they notate to their clients where all the other places they provide services. I mean, I don't know. Do you guys want that in there as part of to add it into the informed consent?
I think I was just confused if we wanted to or not. I think that's right. I thought we didn't land. I didn't realize we landed on one way or another.
No.
No. I hear several no's.
I mean, I think it's confusing. So I would say no, just by being confused. But.
All right. Thank you for that.
But what are your thoughts, Ms. Sabal?
I think the intent behind it was, was to ensure that ethics were being followed. And I think that the therapeutic relationship piece, did you know any more about what his intent behind that was? I'm reading it now and I feel like there was more to it. Sorry.
No, from my conversation and the feedback was, it was just kind of an additional way to clarify and be clear about what we can and can't do as therapists. And I think to your point, it was just more specific language than we had put in already. That's all.
Yeah, I think it continues on to the second page where it talks about including a statement that sexual intimacy with a client is never appropriate and so forth, but we discussed that.
Yeah, he was just giving the language from the other state he's licensed in, and that's just embedded in it. So,
yeah.
Cool. Do we have a motion?
For your motion?
Just to clarify, so we would be, the motion would be for adopting the final draft of proposed rulemaking with modifications.
I move to adopt the final draft of the proposed rulemaking with the modifications discussed.
Miller, second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Sorry, once, just wait. Sorry.
Go ahead.
One question.
Yep.
So right now, when we said no, did we say we were going to remove the explanation of like sexual intimacy and that kind of stuff?
No, we would still. So
I know it's all in one thing, so I'm getting lost.
Yeah, no, it's okay. So we have it, the way we have it is the description of the professional nature of the therapeutic relationship.
Never mind. I'm good. Yay.
Which is a little bit more broad, but also means we're going to need to provide clarity when that time comes.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's it. All right. Back to the motion. I have a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Motion carries. Thank you. All right. Next is item 15. Call for public comment. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on any given public matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 5 minutes to do so, pursuant to ARS 38431.01I. The board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Action on public comment matters that are not listed on the agenda will be limited to directing staff to study the matter or to schedule the matter for further discussion at a later date. Do we have anybody from the public that wishes to address the board? You can come to the front.
turn the microphone on and then state your name for the record. Thank you.
My name is Robert Daugenbaugh. That's Daugenbaugh. I'm a LIAC, and I'm here also on behalf of the Arizona Association of Addiction Professionals. We want to thank the board for their support that they've done through this change in our licensure from LISAC and so on to LIAC, and also for the proposed changes in the rules that brings us in parity with the other disciplines in terms of education or CEUs and everything like that. And this was very enlightening today. And so I want to thank you all for that.
Thank you for being here. We appreciate your presence. Anybody else? Yes, come to the front. Turn the microphone on and state your name for the record.
Can you push the button?
There you go.
Okay. Hello, my name's Christine Hendricks, K-R-I-S-T-I-N-E, Hendricks, H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S. I'm LPC. I had no idea I was going to talk today, so this is kind of strange. I am a EFT, emotionally focused therapist. I'm certified. So when everyone was talking about, I was like, whoo. I think, just so you all know, if there's going to be a treatment plan, I think it should be best practice for whatever modality you use. If you do crisis management, obviously a four session, that's not appropriate. That's not best practice. But what I can tell you and there are more than a few of us, we're actually pretty big. And but what we do is we see a couple together for the first session. Then we see the couple individually for session two and three. And then we see them together for the fourth session. And that's when we create the treatment plan. So I think the way it's written or the way you changed it will totally work. So I just wanted to kind of enlighten you. So what we were afraid of is if it had to be done in the fourth session, then now we're out of compliance. And EFTers are, we're rural followers and we want to do the right thing. And it honestly does not sit well with me to do a treatment plan, you know, by the fifth session and know I'm out of compliance. That totally freaks me out. So, so I just wanted to kind of share with you so you know, like, why we need a little bit more time with doing systems work. So
thank you. I appreciate the comment.
Thank you.
Any other member of the public? All right. Having none. Next item is item 16. The next regular meeting is scheduled for Friday, June 13th at 9 a.m. at 1740 West Adams Street, Boardroom C.
And we have Mr. Madera and Ms. Groves out for June. Is there anybody else that's out for June?
I think I am.
Can you just clarify the July date again?
July 25th.
Okay, I wrote that down and then I still didn't trust myself.
Mr. Charles, what was that?
If my passport goes through, then I will not be here. But if it doesn't, I will be here.
Will you let me know?
I will know very soon.
Thank you.
All right.
And the 25th, I'm still 50.
Okay.
Regionals does.
All right. Now meeting, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Dennis moves.
Henning in second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Meeting's adjourned at 1:32. Thank you all for being here.
Okay.
See you next month.
I have the wrong month. I'm good.
You're good?
Yeah, I was looking at July.